morning. Welcome to the California Coastal Commission for August 14th, and we're happy to be in sunny Chula Vista. And we will begin with a call to order and a roll call from Vanessa to confirm that we have a quorum.
Commissioner Bochco.
Here.
Commissioner Cox.
Here.
Commissioner Groen.
Present.
Commissioner Howell.
Here.
Commissioner Jones.
Here.
Commissioner McClure.
Here.
Commissioner Schellenberger.
Here.
Commissioner Turnbull Sanders.
Here.
Commissioner Yaranga. Commissioner Vargas.
Here.
Chair Kinsey.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. And now let's take up whether there are any addenda changes. And Dan Carl is with us. Good morning, Dan.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey. Commissioners, before walking through the agenda changes, I just note for the public, if you're here to address the commission, if you could complete a speaker slip, they're available at the front table out in the hall, both for public comment and for agenda items today. And if you could also turn off your cell phones or put them in quiet mode, that would be really helpful so as not to disrupt the proceedings. With respect to agenda changes for today, there are two, and the first one is on agenda page 15. This is item number 7B. This is the Blackman and O'Connell appeal. This one's been postponed. And the next one is on the next page. This is item number 11C. This is the appeal of the Port San Luis Harbor District Harbor Terrace project. That appeal has been withdrawn. The project wasn't withdrawn. The appeal was withdrawn, so there won't be a hearing on that. And that completes the agenda changes.
Thank you, Dan. So now we will go to our public comment for this morning for up to 30 minutes. And we'll begin with Shay Benton, followed by Susan Jordan. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Shay Benton from the San Diego Regional EDC. I just want to go ahead and thank you for taking the time to thoughtfully consider SeaWorld's Blue World project coming up before you in October. This is a $100 million project in San Diego that benefits not only the tourism and research economic sectors, but also includes a 500,000 labor hours for local construction jobs. So I would just urge your support of that when it comes before you in October. Thank you.
Thank you. Susan?
I'm going to wait till it comes up. There we go. Okay. I wish I could have done this yesterday when Allison gave her update on the Plains Refugio oil spill in Santa Barbara. But as you know, on May 19th, there was an oil spill in Santa Barbara. It was quite a bit larger than was initially reported, so far 40% larger, according to the company's own numbers. We don't have official state numbers. And within days, we were getting reports of excessive tar on southern beaches, and by that I mean Ventura, Los Angeles. And at first, I was a doubter. I didn't think that could really happen. But then I was informed by a UCSB professor who had a model that showed that within days, the oil was 8 miles off Santa Barbara. And based on currents and wind conditions, it could easily travel that far south. On June 11th, the commission was down doing a historic district site visit at Crystal Cove. Most of you were on the beach looking at the cottages, and I was looking at the tar on the beach. And I've been to that beach many times. I've seen that park transition from when the public could not access it. And so I took a sample, as did some of your staff, actually. I did report it to the 800 number. I was advised that it did not follow the appropriate chain of custody. You need a peace officer to officially collect it. I advised them to go out and look at it. Unfortunately, no official samples that I know of were actually taken. We were in discussions with DFW every week. We were having conference calls. And on July 16th, when they did the blitz of the four counties, they actually flew into Santa Barbara and collected my sample. which I had taken home with me and put in a jar, which is what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to put it in plastic, and I had kept it in my freezer. And then, it was July 10th when they collected my sample. And then on July 16th, DFW informed us that of the 44 samples collected in the Blitz officially, only one tested positive. And the other one that tested positive was my sample. So I think the lesson learned here is that, one, oil spills are not static. They move significantly. I mean, this is Orange County. It could have gone further south. We don't really know yet because of potential litigation. They're not releasing where they sampled and what those other results were. We do have a confirmed sample from two confirmed samples from Manhattan Beach. So I just wanted to let you know that. And I also wanted to thank DFW and Director Bonham for taking my sample, even though it wasn't an official chain of custody, testing it and reporting out the results. Although they don't report it in the media because it's, quote unquote, not official. But it still means something. Thank you.
Thank you. Chanel Hawken, followed by Leah Renee and George Abram.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Commission. My name is Chanel Hawken. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy at the San Diego Regional Chamber. We have over 4,000 business members, 80% of them small business. And I'm here to recommend support of SeaWorld's Blue World project as it comes in October to Long Beach, my hometown. I also wanted to thank you for your support yesterday for the airport's parking plaza. SeaWorld is the largest tenant in the city of San Diego, and the Blue World project will be a great enhancement of tourism, economic research, and development. And we are pleased to support it at the Chamber, and we'll see you in Long Beach. Thank you. And I apologize for it's my day off, so I'm casual and I have my kids, and I usually give people a hard time about that, but I'm that person today, so. But I am going to the water, so have fun today.
Have a great day yourself.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, my name is Leah Renee, and I apologize for not being more formal. It came to my attention yesterday, and I'm without words because I thought it was a welcome improvement. On July 1st, Chief Counsel Peterson sent me a letter saying that you had removed everything back and rendered it invalid correctly, as the law states, and that I could go back to the city of Los Angeles. So I've been every single day in the city of Los Angeles getting this processed. Nothing's changing. I received a letter, and I'm going to give it all to you. It's right here. It's current. I got it yesterday, and I got it certified a week ago, that you're still holding up the process. And it's active online. I don't sleep. I barely eat. I cannot work. I live in fear that your Coastal Commission staff is aiding and abetting this builder to circumvent my notice, my due process, and equal protection of the law. It is now 34 months. He has an order to comply from the city of Los Angeles that says he's in violation of the law, and it's a misdemeanor. It says he has to get all permits. If he goes back to the city of Los Angeles, I can make him comply with the law. He did not get the right grading permits. So when I bring up grading, if nobody declares it, and you're on a landslide, and you've got Coastal Del Mar, I said something the other day was really awful for me because I don't like to tell anyone I went to the FBI. But I want you to know what the FBI said to me. No one's going to help you. No one's going to help you. Just make sure you don't turn out to be La Conchita. And if you all know, La Conchita, people died. And in Seattle, in this process, people died. I happened to be at the top. I didn't know when I bought my property. I happened to be at the top on the first house, row of houses, on the top of a massive landslide. It's documented by everybody. Everybody knows, and nobody talks about it, and they are concealing it. And it was required in the 1970s to disclose it. So I've been paper trailing it. That's actually how I found the Corona Del Mar and Altada. I happened to it because it's in the same, it's a different tract. So please don't combine that tract. If they don't want to disclose their grading and everything, that's their position. I just want to make sure that we all get notice, due process, and equal protection of law. Because if I don't have that, I'm deprived of everything. And I'm stuck living for 35 days preparing for what I'm going to say to you for 3 minutes. minutes and I'm so nervous I break down. The reality is, here it is. It blames you. It's certified from the City of Los Angeles, and I'm going to read it real quick. It says, as per Chief Inspector Michael Tharp, I have it dated for 11/8 yesterday, but this one's certified on July 28, 2015. Permit is to remain active due to project being held up from the Coastal Commission. So there they are. So when people make fun of me or say bad things about me, here it is. This is why I'm still here.
I yield my time to Lee in case she needs additional time.
I invited George. I had never met George. I started seeing things because they were bullying me in your office. I called him because he was watching what was happening in the City of Los Angeles. Everybody knows there's a problem. We know that the City of Los Angeles has a problem. It goes back, you can paper trail it back to the 20s. Please don't have your Coastal Commission staff be the getaway car for the City of Los Angeles. When you know the City of Los Angeles is doing something wrong, return it to them and make them comply with the law. But if you give them an escape hatch where they can keep coming to you, we keep coming and pleading for you to help, and you don't know what's going on, and I got to distill it down. I'm learning, and I'll get better, and I will keep showing up, and God willing, I just show up every day and speak up, because there's a big sign in downtown City Hall that says speak up. So anyway, I want you to know, have George go on record so he can tell you what he's watched as a witness, because the reason I invited him along is so there's a witness to this, because it's so frightening. I mean, it's very, very frightening how people get away with this. So I'm going to have you validate whatever you see, okay? Whatever you know to be true. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Please formally render your applications online, because I had a geologist say, well, everything's approved by the Coastal Commission. He went and looked online, so he used your online application that says staff is recommending approval. I put it in a PowerPoint for you, but... You know, I'm a little late on the timing, you know, too close together. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I wish to confirm everything that Leah has been saying to be true. She brought me in because at one point in the San Francisco office, they made some statements about her behaving improperly. And she felt that she needed someone to protect her. And from my own experience in the City of Los Angeles with illegal actions by government bodies, I was well attuned to this kind of abuse. One of the problems we have is that the staff tends to mislead people, telling them statements that are contrary to the letter of the law, and only if you are independently aware of what the law actually is will they then admit the truth of what the process really is. So the incident that we referred to on Wednesday in public comment was another example of the kind of abuse that we and presumably other citizens experience when they try to challenge the authority of the staff and to insist that they conform to the law. So this is the problem, and I hope you'll investigate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Rhodes.
Hi, Catherine Rhodes from Point Loma, and just going to read you United States Code Chapter 14, Section 47107B, that talks about the airports that are grandfathered in, and basically it includes the Port of San Diego, New York, New Jersey, San Francisco, and in fact the World Trade Center, also Boston Central Artery, the Big Dig, and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge used airport revenue for regional CIP projects because it's state tied lands. So there's this big, huge exception to the rule for state tied lands. And it's also here in this government document, it's the responsibility of the FAA airport district offices and regional offices to advise sponsors on the statutes, grants, assurance, and policy that outline the permitted and prohibited use of airport revenue and to ensure that sponsors are not in violation of the federal obligations in using the airport revenue. So what that means is the local FAA airport district office gives a ruling to, they should give it to you, and I'm sure they already gave it to you for San Francisco, just not for San Diego. that we could use this money for regional infrastructure projects. And so, you know, just to change a little things, you know, I love development. So anyway, here's my solution for a Chargers stadium on the waterfront, a contiguous expansion of the existing convention center, no new taxes, no gifts of public land like they're trying to do for Mission Valley, no public vote required. So what my plan is to consolidate regional planning of the airport authority and the port to our metropolitan planning organization, which is SANDIC. And that means the money from the airport and the port can be used for SANDIC. And then SANDIC, but of course we have a problem with SANDIC because they pretend that we can only use the money for transportation projects, when the regional plan has to do with affordable housing, housing the homeless, regional transportation, airports, and regional infrastructure. So that's how I plan on funding the Chargers Stadium without taxes or a gift of public land. So my idea is a 15-acre multi-purpose contiguous waterfront site on San Diego Bay. And what I really want to do is redevelop all the tidelands by doing something I call a full tidelands reclamation as a pilot project and proof of concept. And what you would do is you would remove the liquefiable soils to bedrock, create a stable foundation, and then you could actually capture your urban stormwater runoff by using bulkhead sister structural foundations similar to the dry docks and the World Trade Center. So I love development, but we can't even get past the seismic issue, and that's planning 101, and that's why I've been here for 10 years. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, that completes our public comment for today, and we'll come back. And we have trailed a few items, including our enforcement report from yesterday, and so we're going to welcome Lisa Hagee and get an update. That's something that I had requested, that we be kept apprised as a commission of the progress since having that new fining authority given to us for a five-year period last year. Lisa?
Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
As the chair said, this is a report that people have had been asking us for, and I want to report about information about our work done to implement the commission's recently acquired statutory authority under 308.21 of the Coastal Act. As you know, this authority allows the Commission to impose administrative penalties for violations of the Coastal Act's provisions regarding public access. As you may recall, it was enacted through last year's budget bill through the leadership of Assembly Speaker Tony Atkins. The original bill would have provided for administrative penalties for all violations, but the final bill was narrowed to address penalties for public access-related violations only. I'm pleased today to let you know how effective this new authority under 308.21 has been in securing timely compliance with the Coastal Act. Most important, in a significant number of cases, Section 308.21 has led to significant compliance and restored public access in a far faster time frame than we might typically see. Although we have yet to bring a formal action to you for the imposition of penalties, Section 308.21 has been very successful in resolving access issues. In fact, it has worked to resolve cases and provide access quickly without ever requiring the issuance of penalties. We'd always intended that administrative penalties would provide a deterrent to reduce violations and, in particular, to provide an incentive for violators to resolve the violations more quickly. Indeed, this was the very purpose of the notice provisions and daily penalty provisions, which we'll discuss in a minute, which was to avoid and reduce violations whenever possible. That said, of course, not all of our cases are that easy to resolve, and there are a few cases in which Section 308.21 has still not led to resolution. The unresolved cases include some older cases in which resolution has long proven difficult, and some newer ones with difficult issues. We're working on these cases as well and expect that one or more of them will be coming to you in the near future. Because of that potential, I can't discuss the details of those cases in this presentation today, but will instead focus on overall analysis and numbers arising from our implementation efforts thus far and highlight some of the successful cases. I also note that Section 308.21 only became effective in June of last year, and it was made effective immediately because it was part of the budget trailer bill. We spent a significant part of the last year working on devising our authority as well, a program to look for and identify access cases amongst all of our violations. In turn, we have ramped up our correspondence, investigation, and outreach on those cases. Within this first year, we've already managed to bring to resolution a number. We hope that in the next year ahead, we can resolve even a larger number of public access cases under Section 308.21. We have a PowerPoint for this, and I'd like to go to slide 2. It says item 9A. First of all, I'm going to do a little bit of schooling here, and I'm going to do a brief overview of Section 308.21 since some of the commissioners are new since it was passed. For a more detailed discussion, you can look at the staff report at pages 2 and 3, and the Exhibit 1 to the staff report is an actual copy of the statutory language itself. Section 308.21, as this slide says, allows the commission to impose by a majority vote at a hearing an administrative civil penalty for violations of the public access provisions of the Coastal Act, which include the violation of any CDP conditions that require the dedication of public access or any other access-related permit conditions. The amount of the penalty is based on 75% of the civil penalties the commission is authorized to seek from court in civil litigation, or a maximum of $11,250 per day for each violation. The amount of penalties will be determined based on the factors in the current penalty section of the Coastal Act used for judicial actions, Section 308.20C, and those are the nature, circumstance, extent, and gravity of the violation, the ability to restore the violation, the sensitivity of the resources impacted, the cost to the state of bringing the action, and the degree to which the violator has voluntarily resolved the violation, their prior history of violations, their degree of culpability, and their economic profits flowing from the violations, as well as a catch-all of other such matters as justice may require. As in the original judicial penalty provisions in the Coastal Act, the new section assesses penalties or provides the authority for you to assess penalties on a daily basis to provide the incentive to address violations as quickly as possible, but also has a 5-year cap on accrual of penalties. However, 5 years of $11,250 a day is in the millions. Next slide. Section 308.21 also has provisions to address some de minimis violations and to provide a grace period in certain specified instances. The statute states that the legislature intended to ensure that the violations that are unintentional, minor, and cause only de minimis harm will not be subject to penalties if the violator acts expeditiously to correct the violation. Next slide. Second, 308H also allows for a 30-day window in certain circumstances for which the violation may be cured and admin penalties avoided. This 30-day time frame does not apply to violations of a previously issued CDP, for obvious reasons since the CDP itself provided notice, or to violations that require a CDP to correct. Although not always legally required, enforcement staff have, in many of the cases offered thus far, the 30 days to resolve the violations in order to provide some time to resolve the cases. Next slide. Also under 308.21, violators cannot be subject to admin penalties and civil liability under the Coastal Act for the same violation. Next slide. The provision also has some provisions to address the failure to comply with the penalty imposed by the commission. First, under 308.21E, if a person refuses to pay an admin penalty assessed by you, the commission may record a lien on the property in the amount of the violation. This is different than under our current statute, which we can record a NOVA for other existing violations, but that doesn't have the legal effect of a lien. It just is a notice provision. The lien actually has legal effects. May serve to motivate people to resolve violations prior to sale or refinancing. Next slide. 308.21 also states that if a person refuses to pay an imposed administrative penalty after your hearing or otherwise fails to comply with orders issued by the commission related to admin penalties or challenges the actions, the commission essentially retains all enforcement authority under the Coastal Act to otherwise resolve the violation and seek relief through the courts. Next slide. As a final background note, I would also say that under Section 3821, the admin penalties do not apply to local governments, special districts, or other agencies when acting in a legislative or adjudicatory capacity. Next slide. Okay, so now I'd like to talk about how it's worked out and I give you a broad overview of our 3821 cases over the last year. Over the first year, we've worked as quickly as possible to identify, investigate, send letters referencing 30821, and meet with parties to seek resolution in as many potential cases as possible. We applied the provisions of the new authority both to newly identified access-related cases and to some of the access-related cases that we'd opened previously, as far as we could get the resources to go back and do that. Although the pool of cases we have first focused on doesn't include all of the previously opened public access violations, as of August 10th, 2015, we had identified and begun to apply the provisions in 48 access-related cases. And those are the cases that I'm going to focus on to give you a little bit of analysis about how they went. 11 of these were newly reported and opened in 2015, and the remainder were prior cases, in which we redoubled our efforts based on 30821. On this slide, you can see that there's a broad geographic range of the access cases, with the numbers of cases ranging from 2 to 14 in each district. There were 2 in the north, 3 in the north central, 16 in the central, 9 in south central, 8 in the south coast district, and 10 in the San Diego coast district. I should also note that, to our delight, the commission recently hired a district enforcement officer for the north coast in Arcata. It's our first enforcement presence in that office for over a decade. So although the cases are low here, we anticipate them going up in the future, and we're very excited about that. Next slide. Of these cases, enforcement staff has sent written notice to in 40 cases. We are actively working on these cases, so literally daily numbers change, but these numbers are accurate as of this week. In 7 additional cases, we gave verbal notice to the alleged violator of 30821, and that was enough to start negotiations. In one new case, we worked with the county directly to resolve the violation. So as you can see in this chart, out of the 48 cases, 24, or 50%, have been resolved, meaning that an agreement to resolve the violation was reached and the violations were completely resolved, or principally resolved. Additionally, in 9 more cases, the commission staff has secured an agreement for the resolution of the violation, and the work is required is either in progress or due to begin shortly. We call these cases resolution pending for our tracking purposes. In those cases, typically access has been restored, but a follow-up CDP may be required or the submittal of an access plan is needed. Thus, the total of 33 cases, or 63% of the cases in which we utilize Section 30821, the case is either resolved or soon to be resolved. In 7 additional cases, we are in active negotiations and are hopeful that resolution will follow. So this means in the aggregate that 38 of the 48 cases, or 83%, we have had either resolution or are actively working on resolution and continue to move positively towards resolution. There are 8 cases, unfortunately, in which the assertion of 30821 has not yet appeared to bring the violation close to resolution. I should note that of those 8, 4 are older elevated cases that have went long difficult, and 4 are new cases that were in the process of pursuing a formal action. We anticipate bringing one of these elevated cases to you in the very near future for formal action. Next slide. On this slide, you can see a broad overview of some of the types of access cases we've addressed so far, based on the sample of 24 fully resolved cases. The types of cases arising under the Coastal Act are broad and involve a number of different kinds of access issues, but for these purposes, we've grouped them into a few illustrative categories. And I would note that as we do more cases and there are more kinds of fact patterns, they won't fall into all of the neatly into these categories, but this is just to give you an idea of what we've found so far. And also, the numbers here don't add up to 24 because some of the cases involved more than one issue. But as this bar chart shows you, in our set of resolved cases so far, we have 8 in which a no parking or no trespassing sign was removed, 7 in which encroachments blocking a public right-of-way were removed, 5 involving the removal of gates or fences blocking a public access way, and 5 in which public access signs had been required by a permit but had not been installed and are now in place directing the public to their points of coastal access as a result of the enforcement action under 30821. So what does all of this mean? I just wanted to note, before we go into case examples, some of the general trends. Two things I wanted to note, and we're excited and think both are very positive. First, we've been able to resolve a relatively high percentage of access cases using the potential for imposition of admin penalties as an incentive. As I mentioned, we've resolved 63% of our cases this past year and have either basically resolved or in negotiations. These numbers are a lot higher than what we would typically see. Just as one point of comparison, we looked at the number of access cases resolved in prior years and did a rough calculation. And our estimate was that of the cases opened and closed from July 1, 2004 to July 1, 2014, which is the 10 years immediately preceding the enactment of 308-21, it indicates that we were historically closing about 5 access cases per year. This is obviously dramatically more that we've resolved in the last year than we did on an average in the prior years. Secondly, the cases in which 308-21 has been invoked have been typically resolved in a significantly shorter amount of time than typical cases where we don't have administrative penalties. For instance, in the cases that we have definitively resolved statewide in the last year, the average number of days from a letter citing 308-21 to the resolution of the violation has been 39 days. I know that may not sound fast to you, but that is lightning speed in the world of enforcement. This compares extremely favorably to estimates of our historic resolution time periods for access cases. Just in San Diego, for instance, we estimate that the average time for a normal resolution of an access-related case, that is, the time elapsed between a case being opened and closed, in the 10 years previous to 308-21 was 439 days. In the South Coast District, the average time of resolution of an access case in the 2 years prior was estimated at 180 days. As you can see, cases that might once have taken years are now being resolved significantly faster. Another way to illustrate the effectiveness of 308-21 in both resolving cases and doing so more quickly is to use the example of a couple of specific cases. There was a San Diego access case that had been open for a long time before 308-21 became law. That case had been open and unresolved for 1,906 days before the letter citing 308-21 was sent in October of 2014. You can imagine how frustrating that is. Within 10 days after that letter was sent, the property owner had agreed to resolve the violation and submitted an access signage plan. Similarly, in a case in Santa Cruz had been open for 3,491 days before a letter referencing 308-21 was sent in April of 2015. Within 40 days of that letter, the case was resolved and full access restored. Obviously, these cases were not resolved merely with the letter. We're just using that as a marker to show the amount of time it takes from letter to resolution. But the legal authority of the commission to assess administrative penalties was critical to providing the incentive to resolve these cases at long last. And we're obviously thrilled that we've been able to address access cases in this way, and we believe that if we had similar authority for other types of violations, we would see a similar uptick in our ability to resolve them. So with that background, we want to turn to a few success stories that highlight our progress, and I'd like to go to slide 12. Excellent. On this slide, for instance, this is funny because this is the absence of a violation. The area outlined in yellow is the place where an illegal no parking sign was removed in Santa Cruz. Isn't that funny? We're going to do an overview of some of the types of public access cases we're working on under 308-21 and show how quickly some of them were resolved. I'm going to first head to Northern California, although I would note for various reasons, including geography, development patterns, population density, more of our 308-21 work has taken place in the Southland, although we're hopeful that we will do more in the North as well, especially in the far North. Next slide. The first case I'd like to discuss exemplifies an issue we're dealing with all up and down the coast of California and has gotten a lot of press, the placement of multiple unpermitted no parking signs. These signs are often difficult to address. They're often indistinguishable from real official signs and sometimes are placed where it's difficult to identify who even put them up. In this case, private owners placed numerous no parking signs in the Pleasure Point area of Santa Cruz County, some of which are located with red stars on this map. Next slide. Here we can see a pocket beach at Pleasure Point Park with public walking and biking trail located on the bluff top. Pleasure Point Park has no off-site public parking, and the illegal no parking signs thereby had a significant impact on access. The placement of no parking signs such as these are development under the Coastal Act, as you know, and would have required a CDP and did not have one. Moreover, the signs purport to privatize public parking, illegally reduce the supply of street parking in the area, and thereby limit the public's access to beaches and other recreation. Next slide. Here are photos of some of the myriad of signs that were placed. You can also see in the picture on the bottom right, and a particularly creative move, the violations included the placement of numbers that were stenciled on the pavement parking spaces on public roads to give the impression that the spaces were somehow private or only available to designated persons. Our staff sent letters to the various property owners in June of this year, citing 308-21 and requesting a removal of the signs. Each of the property owners promptly agreed to remove and comply and remove the illegal signage. By July 24th, all the signs were removed. Obviously, the threat of administrative penalties pursuant to 308-21 was critical. Another type of case we typically see involves the blocking off of public access, whether by fences, gates, or other encroachments. And I wanted to just quickly make note of a case that you may be familiar with that was also arising in Northern California, the Ontario Ridge in San Luis Obispo County. There, the commission issued a unilateral cease and desist order to remove fences and gates placed to block public access to coastal trails. The case came to you, unfortunately, right after the enactment of 308-21, and it was too early for us to provide legal notice for the imposition of penalties at that hearing. But I wanted to report back to you that the potential that you would come, that we would bring it back to you for administrative penalties, was clear. Was the clear motivation in finally getting this case resolved and get the removal of the fences. And I just wanted to note that typically when we issue unilateral orders, we get sued and we spend years and years in litigation. And in this case, rather than facing that litigation, the party decided to remove the fences rather than sue over the order. And so not only did it resolve the access violation more quickly, it saved the commission and the Attorney General's office a lot of resources. Next slide. Another Northern California case recently resolved involved multiple property owners privatizing a public view area located 1 mile southeast of Twin Lakes State Beach in Santa Cruz. This case is another common public access violation that we deal with, which are encroachments into accessways. And they're generally accessways that were acquired by the commission as part of a permit action to protect public access. Next slide. The matter involved multiple parties with unpermitted encroachments into a lateral bluff top public access easement. It was included specifically to provide the public with a viewing area to walk to and on and to enjoy the scenic views of the ocean. It wasn't actually a trail leading anywhere. It itself was supposed to be the amenity to allow the public to appreciate the views of the ocean. They were required in CDPs issued by the commission, and the red outline shows where the public access viewing easement is generally located. And it's very important here to provide views to the public, and especially important because to the members of the public that can't climb down the steep rocky path to reach the beach, which is shown on the right-hand side of the slide. Next slide. This public viewing area is supposed to be 10 feet wide, but here we can see that the placement of private landscaping, walkways, and steps had occurred within the red area. The blue outline shows the narrow area that was left for public access, which was less than half the space set aside for the public in the CDP. As it is, the viewing area was very narrow and uninviting and didn't provide the public use and viewing that the CDP required. Next slide. Although, as you can see on the photo on the right, great views of the ocean are available from this public viewing area, the unpermitted encroachments impeded public access. As seen on the photos on the left, many visitors cycle here and use it for the scenic outlook. Unfortunately, as you can see, two members of the public couldn't even comfortably walk side by side, much less use the viewing area. And when used by very many people, it becomes very crowded easily. Next slide. In late February, enforcement staff sent letters to each of the property owners giving them notice of the applicability of the section. By the end of March, all six property owners had removed the encroachments from the easement area. As shown on the right of this slide, as part of the resolution of this violation, all of the property owners agreed to submit CDP amendment applications to provide further access improvements to the area, including an expanded pathway, access signage, and other improved amenities, such as a bike rack. This CDP amendment will be heard later today as part of the Central Coast District Deputy's Director Report, and we hope will further improve the public access. The issue of private encroachments into public access space is one that has been prevalent and ongoing along our coast. In many instances, these cases take a long time to resolve. In this case, the administrative penalty authorities was critical to reaching an agreement quickly, even though this case had been open a long time prior to its passage. Next slide. The next case illustrates how 3821 applies to public access violations arising from some of the older permits. In this case, the violation was addressed over the last few weeks of July and the beginning of August. Pursuant to a CDP, a number of access signs and trails were required to be installed and maintained at the De Anza Mobile Home Park in Santa Cruz near Natural Bridges State Beach. Next slide. There are a number of roads within the residential complex, and public access signage is obviously essential to ensure the public can find its way to the beach and to provide for lateral access through the complex. And therefore, that was why it was required as a condition of the permit. However, over time, the required signs were removed and others were illegible. Commission staff discussed the violations with the property owner and in the context of 308-21. Within a few weeks, the required signs, two of which are depicted on this slide, were installed and again are public. Providing the public with notice of the accessway. Next slide. I'd like to highlight one more case in San Luis Obispo, which typifies another common type of public access violation. Cases in which a CDP condition requiring public access is never completely fulfilled, although the rest of the development project approved in the CDP has been finished. Slide 24. Here is a 1983 CDP for the resort requiring construction of a public beach access stairway near a hotel, providing important access to a beach that is otherwise mostly inaccessible, and the provision of public parking for the stair. Next slide.
That's where we stay.
However, the public parking spaces, and you may recognize this since the commission recently met at this hotel, the public parking spaces were not signed properly and were not set aside and segregated adequately, and they weren't made exclusively available to the public, which was obviously inconsistent with the CDP. The spaces were often being used by resort guests. Staff sent a letter in early May of this year citing 308-21. The resort owner quickly agreed to provide the required parking spaces, remove any development blocking them, and provide employee training on the conditions requiring public parking. Next slide. Here's a picture of the new, more prominent stenciling on each of the public parking spots installed this June as a result of staff's discussions with the property owner, which emphasized that the parking is for the public only and not to be used by hotel guests. In addition, the owner has committed to both providing new and improved signage and to provide evidence that the training of employees has occurred. So now I would like to turn to Southern California. Next slide. And highlight a few successfully resolved cases in Southern California in the area between Malibu and San Diego. These red stars shown identify the locations of some of the cases in which we have used the influence of Section 3821 to resolve violations. Next slide. As some of you may have heard in news and other reports, the California Coastal Commission and the State Lands Commission resolved a significant dispute regarding public access at Paradise Cove. The beach at Paradise Cove is accessible from Pacific Coast Highway by private road and a parking lot owned by Paradise Cove Land Company, which operates a restaurant and a residential mobile home park. Although private property is located landward of the mean high tide line, the area below the mean high tide line is public. Furthermore, the pier and the area immediately adjacent to it are also public and leased by the company from the State Lands Commission. In the lease, the company agreed to provide free public access to the pier and adjacent lands, including to the ocean. Next slide. However, the property owner had long charged substantial access fees to walk-on visitors and banned the public from certain activities, such as bringing surfboards to the public beach. Only residents of a gated community and their guests were allowed to carry surfboards across the sand to the surf break, which, again, are public waters. The owner had also kept the public pier closed to public access by a locked gate. These actions were unpermitted under the Coastal Act and a violation of the lease with the State Lands Commission. Both the Coastal Commission and the State Lands Commission issued separate letters to the resort owner in November, citing the authority to impose fines up to $11,250 a day for violations. Next slide. Within a month after being contacted, the property owner ceased charging the walk-in fee, removed all signs banning surfing, and opened the gate at the foot of the Paradise Cove Pier. You can see in this photo, for example, that the walk-in charge has been removed from the sign. Next slide. Here we can see the pier at the end of the pedestrian walk, which was opened as a result of our work under Section 308-21. I should note, however, that the unfortunately the pier is temporarily closed for repairs, but those repairs and that closure was authorized by a CDP issued by the commission. Although the pier itself is temporarily closed pursuant to that permit, the other areas adjacent to the pier covered by the lease are still open to the public and provide access to the public areas below the mean high tide line, including access to the water. You can see on the right a view up the coast from the pier. Moreover, to protect public access in perpetuity, the new CDP required installation of at least two signs indicating that the area is open for public access. This is an example of our need to remain vigilant. Even after this access was opened up, we have received reports of additional concerns, and we're investigating them at Paradise Cove. But it just shows that we need to keep on these cases and continue to monitor them. And we believe that 308.21 gives us the authority to do that and to have some teeth when we find additional violations. I'd like to turn now to another case, slide 32. That involves a blocked access, and in this case, it's to Escondido Beach in the city of Malibu. The location of the accessway is marked by the red star. This highlights another type of public access violation we're now addressing, the cases in which the commission required the improvement of a vertical access easement in conditions of a prior CDP, but that accessways remain blocked by unpermitted development. The CDP here, for example, was approved by the commission in 1983. Many of these cases have remained open enforcement violation cases, and for one reason or another, we've not been able to resolve them. However, we are now seeing that with the addition of 308.21, long-stalled cases such as this one can be focused on again and resolved. Next slide. In this accessway, staircases snake down the bluff to Escondido Beach, which has very limited public access. You can see in the yellow arrow where the staircases are. The upper staircase departs from PCH at Joffrey's Restaurant. The resolution to which I'll be referring involves the lower portion of the accessway nearest the beach. Next slide. As you can see in this picture, the lower portion of the easement has been blocked by unpermitted landscaping and a fence with gates, which you can see in the middle of the slide. You'd hardly really guess that that was an open and legally required public access way, would you? Additionally, the owner did not put up the signs and didn't improve the accessway for public use as was required by the CDP. In September of 2014, we gave notice to the property owner that they could be subject to administrative penalties under this section if they did not correct the violations. Next slide. Ta-da. The property owners were immediately interested in resolving the violations, and we worked with the property owner, and the unpermitted fence and gate have now been removed. You can see the dashed yellow rectangle in the center of the photo shows where that was previously located. And the accessway is now open for the public. Next slide. We're working with the agent's owner to finalize the plans for improvements to the stairway and on appropriate public access signage. But in the meantime, the stairs are now open to the public to access the beach, as you can see. We wanted to show you how quickly some of these cases are moving. And in some cases, like this one, this is not included in our fully resolved category. This is in the pending category, just to show you an example, because it takes a longer to fully resolve all the violations. But in the meantime, even the ones that we've gotten partial compliance with have restored access to the public, and which is very exciting. Now, since we're having a local hearing, I'd like to ask some of our CRAC California enforcement staff to present information on some of the cases they've worked on. First off is Andrew Willis, who is our newly promoted Southern California Enforcement Supervisor. He previously worked in Long Beach, and he personally worked on the cases that he's going to report on today. Andrew?
Thank you, Lisa. Good morning, commissioners. Next slide, please. In the next example, I'd like to highlight how Section 308.21 allows us to move quickly to address an issue where one small change can be made to significantly improve public access. For instance, the addition of one additional sign in a maze of homes can turn a public but hidden beach into a true public resource. On this slide, you have such a beach tucked away in a public beach poor area, indicated by the red star. You can also see how in a developed area, clear, well-placed signage is critical to providing for public access. Next slide, please. In this case, staff discovered that a public beach access sign required by a CDP had not been installed. Without the sign, beachgoers would have no indication that beach access exists. Staff notified the homeowner of the issue and directed the homeowner to install the access sign in order to avoid assessment of administrative penalties. The homeowner quickly installed a commission access sign where it is now visible to passing pedestrians and drivers, as you can see in the photo on the right. The lower portion there is a blow-up of the new access sign. The next slide. Next slide, please. And this is a photograph of the beach that the public is now directed to. As you can see, the beach is a popular landing spot for kayakers making their way through Newport Bay. Next slide, please. Next, I would like to discuss an example of using 308-21 to protect and preserve more informal but long-used access pathways to the coast. This next case involving obstruction of an access path in the location of the red star on the slide is an example of such a situation. Several public access paths created by years of public use crisscross a canyon to reach Trafalgar Street Beach in San Clemente, better known to surfers and beachgoers just as T Street. These paths provide quick and scenic beach access from adjacent streets and parking areas. The yellow lines show the improvised trail network. Next slide, please. Earlier this year, staff received reports from members of the public that fences had been erected at a street end that linked the beach paths to the road network, blocking off public use of some of the trails and therefore access to the beach. The fencing is shown here in photos on the left. Staff sent notice to the owner of the property that the fences were unpermitted development, violations of the Coastal Act, and its public access provisions, and that under 308-21, the property owner could be subject to daily penalties for each day that the fences remained in place. The property owner called staff within days of transmission of the letter. It really was something like Friday to Monday that we got the call back, and agreed to remove the fences. Here on the right, you can see the recent photos of the site after the fences had been removed. And next slide. The trail is now fully open to public use, and this is the beach that is accessed by the trail. Next slide. And the next part of this report will be presented by Marcia Venegas, our San Diego District staffer. She is our local enforcement representative and has personally worked on all the cases she's going to talk about today. Marcia.
Good morning, commissioners. Slide 43, please. A final group of examples of our use of Section 308-21 that we would like to discuss involves several cases in which the Commission has required public access as a CDP condition for a multi-unit residential community. But those public access conditions were never fully complied with, and moreover, steps were actually taken to impede public use. Here, for example, we can see an access way near the Agua Hedionda Lagoon in Carlsbad, identified on this slide by the red stars and the yellow line. The trail here provides an additional connection to another vertical access way leading to a pocket beach on the lagoon. The lagoon is a recreational destination and home to a multitude of plant and animal species. This trail provides a recreational area along the lagoon for walking, enjoying the area, and provides another avenue for the public to access the beach. Next slide. In this case, a 1988 CDP required the provision of public access, public amenities, and signage as a condition of approval. The HOA erroneously assumed that the required time frame in which it had to provide access had lapsed. The HOA then installed a variety of private property signage at the entrances of the trail, some of which is shown here, which discouraged the public from using the trail. Next slide. In early May 2015, enforcement staff sent a letter informing the HOA of the violation that also indicated the applicability of Section 308-21, as well as the potential for daily fines. The HOA quickly removed the private property signs and agreed to install the required Coastal Commission access signage and the missing public amenities required by the permit, such as a bike rack and a drinking fountain that will now be upgraded to be ADA compliant as well. Here again, enforcement staff will continue to monitor compliance with this agreement and the permit requirements. For now, however, basic access has been restored. Next slide. Another case involves a CDP authorizing construction of a multi-unit residential structure on Riviera Drive in San Diego that included a requirement for public access. Here again, the HOA had failed to install the required public signage and also had placed a variety of unpermitted items that precluded the public use of the accessway. Next slide. As you can see here, in such densely built-up areas, public accessways and public access signage is very important for the public to be able to reach the shoreline, in this case, a beach in Mission Bay. Next slide. The property owner had installed numerous obstructions, including gates and a private shower directly within the commission-required accessway. That blocked public access from both the street and the beach side of the property. I would like to highlight here that this involves an older enforcement case dating back to 2009, in which resolution had proved difficult. Commission staff struggled for years to bring the Homeowners Association into compliance with the terms of its CDP and the Coastal Act. In 2013, the Homeowners Association finally agreed to remove the unpermitted gates from the accessway. However, the accessway continued to be effectively closed to the public use. The signage placed was not compliant, and a new no trespassing sign was placed on the beach side of the property in a location that gave the public the clear impression that the stairs from the beach were private and that public use would be trespassing. Next slide. After the enactment of Section 30821, Commission staff contacted the HOA once again and raised the Commission's authority to impose administrative penalties. The HOA then agreed to remove the remaining impediments and have now installed new access signs that clearly inform the public of the beach access across the property. Next slide. The accessway finally is truly open and available as required by the original permit, and here is the public beach accessible from this accessway. Next slide. As another case example, Commission enforcement staff learned in 2012 that public access signage required by a 1974 CDP had not been installed at a large residential complex in La Jolla. Next slide. Again, as in the previous case, signage is especially necessary in this location because massive residential complexes built along the coast can present a significant barrier to beach access. The picture shows the complex as it has appeared to the public. Without signage, there is little to no chance that a beachgoer, not part of the local community, would know of the opportunity to cross the property to access the beach, nor where to do so. Commission enforcement staff sent a notice of violation letter in October of 2014. To the HOA, citing the Commission's authority under Section 30821 to impose administrative penalties for public access violations. Next slide. Within weeks of the letter, the HOA agreed to install new signage that increases the visibility and consequently the usage of this coastal accessway. The HOA recently installed this signage. The City of San Diego also agreed, upon our request, to place an additional sign that was not required by the permit to further clarify and improve the public accessway at this location. Next slide. Horseshoe Beach, which this accessway leads to, provides excellent fishing and surfing conditions. Next slide. As a final example, enforcement staff recently has made significant progress towards resolving another longstanding access violation in the city of Oceanside. The violation again includes the failure to provide public access through a condominium complex as required by a CDP issued in 1979. This case, however, centers on the need to provide lateral public access through the complex. Lateral access, or access along the coastline, is critical at this site because at high tide, the surf pounds against the seaward edge of the complex, making travel in front of the complex dangerous, if not impossible. The seaward extent of the condominiums meant that the construction of the complex would cut off lateral access at high tide between the northern portion of the City of Oceanside Beach and the southern end, where most of the beach parking is located. Therefore, the 1979 CDP required the provision of lateral public access through the complex at high tide. Next slide. However, that access was never provided, and in fact, the complex was gated off. Staff initially learned of the violation in 2005. Over the years, staff sent letters to the HOA and met and discussed noncompliance of the CDP with the HOA with little progress. However, in 2014, Commission's authority to impose administrative penalties under Section 30821 was the underpinning of staff's revisiting the case. Next slide. Thanks to these negotiations, the HOA has now crafted an access program for the site that staff subsequently approved. There is now extensive signage installed at the beachside entrances and throughout the complex, thus making the route through the residential complex easy to find and follow, and maintaining lateral access along the coast at high tide. I note that there are remaining access issues at the site, and we are working on those. However, at this time, it is important to note that lateral access at high tide is now in place at this location. Slide 58. This slide shows a view of the Northern City Beach accessible via the accessway that is a quieter alternative to the beaches to the south of the complex. Now I will return the presentation back to Lisa Hagee. Thank you.
So as you've seen today, a significant number of our cases are resolving and resettling relatively rapidly at the district level. And as I noted before, though, we have a number of cases that are with our headquarters unit in which our authority has been applicable, and yet the cases have not been resolved. And we'll be bringing one of these to you in the very near future. Just briefly, because some people had asked for a little guidance, but the hearing will follow the general procedures used in other enforcement proceedings. We have the regulations for 30821 references the pre-existing regulations under the Coastal Act. The hearing will include the presentation of staff findings on the matter, as well as an analysis of the factors noted at the beginning of this presentation that are arising out of 30821C. And the commission itself will determine the precise amount of the penalties to be imposed. Finally, I just wanted to note that we are also working to expand our 30821 case list. We've been researching our commission records to find older public access condition permit requirements and identify additional violations. We've also been working to increase the exposure of our public access enforcement program, and we've been doing this via a variety of things: our updated website, media outreach, and other efforts to raise the public knowledge of this great new tool that the commission has, with the goal of trying to deter public access violations from occurring in the first place. And as you may note, in the last year, the commission, the enforcement staff, issued a couple of pamphlets. One is how to report violations and when you need a permit, and we've been making those publicly available as well. And they're available also on our website as well as in hard copy. There's obviously still much remaining to be done, but we are, in conclusion, excited and gratified that the early experience shows that the admin penalties can be very effective in both resolving cases and doing so much more quickly than we were able to do in the past. It's allowed us to work with alleged violators quickly, and I would note collaboratively. And it's already borne fruit in the form of access for the public up and down the coast. So that includes our enforcement report, and we're available to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make the broad observation that when this potential authority was going through the legislative process, there were many parties in opposition to it, and one of the arguments was that this was going to become an exercise where staff went out and was extracting money all over the place and an abuse of our authority. And our view of this is that it was always about deterrence and resolution of violations and getting those access amenities on the coast for the public. And if we had the right incentive structure, that would be effective. And I think you've heard today that it's working just as we had hoped it would, and hopefully will continue that way. And as you know, you have yet to levy a fine under this authority, yet we've got huge access benefits already realized through the implementation of this mechanism. So I hope the larger public and those who were following this in the legislature appreciate that and understand that, and maybe, as Lisa suggested earlier, we'll have the opportunity to expand the use of this kind of a tool into the other areas of the Coastal Act that also have many violations pending. So,
thank you. I know that some commissioners are very interested in this, and I'll begin with Commissioner Mitchell and then Commissioner Cox.
I just want to say thank you so much for the presentation. I think it shows you guys are doing a wonderful job, which, you know, I've always been a big fan of the enforcement, because that's where, you know, the rubber meets the road of improving and making access available. So I commend Speaker Atkins and her, you know, intensity in getting this done and doing it through the budget last year, and, you know, even when the bill didn't go, because I think it's a great tool that we have and that, you know, you guys have used so effectively. And I appreciate that the violators are working collaboratively with you after it's been on the books for, you know, several thousand days. but just goes to show what a little deterrent like this will do. So thank you very much for all your hard work.
Thank you. Commissioner Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to say this is one of the best reports I've heard since I've been on the Coastal Commission. So, Lisa, congratulations to you and your staff on a well-presented report. And I just, you know, the proof is obviously right here in front of us. The goal, obviously, is to get compliance. And I really appreciate the fact that while this could have, as Charles had indicated just a few moments ago, it could have been an iron-fisted effort. It really seems like it's more of a velvet glove where you are working with the people that are violators and trying to bring compliance. And I think, you know, obviously, the success you've had is just remarkable. So congratulations to you and your entire team.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, Lisa, when we were talking about fine authority in the legislation, the number thousands was used, of thousands of backlogged enforcement cases. The numbers you showed us today were significantly smaller in terms of open cases. Is that because that's the subset that's just access?
Yes.
And so that means, whereas I thought that there was more like a third or more of the backlog was access, but it, as you've really dug into it, it's really more like a 5% or
no? And actually, your original numbers and impressions were correct. We currently have 2,173 total violations open in the state as of June, and that's a little daunting of a number, I have to admit. Our estimates are that between 30% and 40% of those are access related. So we have a huge number. We have hundreds of numbers of access cases, but, you know, between 400 and 600 if you take the percentages of the total. And we realize that we have our work cut out for us. What we tried to do was we tried to apply 308.21 to all new access cases coming in, and then we started going back to, and some of the ones Marcia reported on were ones that were older cases that we went back and redoubled our efforts based on the new authority. We have a ton of work before us, and I don't mean to be light or make it seem as though we've sort of licked the problem. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and we realize that. So the original numbers of numbers of open access cases is still accurate. We just need to keep working on them.
So I guess, you know, what I would ask you to be thinking about is, what is a strategy that we could apply in over the next four remaining years to see how many of those we could actually touch and perhaps resolve? And what would it take? You know, it's like we have a strategic plan that has a lot of dollar signs when we don't know how the hell we're going to do it, but we need more staff or more support or more consultants. Could we develop a pro bono program where we could get a few quality land use attorneys helping us? Do we go for some special funding? What would we be able to do to take full advantage of this and show what we can do to really address these access issues? Because I think it's fundamental to the Coastal Act, and I think it would show great commitment on our part to the legislature if we want to keep this this right going. So
I do believe that it's a matter of funding and staffing. In our Ventura office, which has the largest number of open cases and also the highest percentage of access-related violations, which is not surprising given the jurisdiction that it covers, our staffer was opening cases as quickly as she could and going back and looking at them, and was very efficient about that. But there's a capacity on how many one person can Absolutely. Work on resolving at one time, and she actually had to stop. She had like 20 that were really active, and we were working towards resolving all of them, but that there's just a capacity. the issue. And as long as we have, we have one enforcement staffer in each district. Actually, we have two districts right now that are open that we need to hire for. But we just have constraints. And unless we had additional staffing, it's hard to see how we could resolve all the cases.
Right. And I'm absolutely clear about that, too, which is why I was talking about what can we do to expand our capacity, and is there a limited term position that we could seek a grant from some philanthropic organization that wants to see access? I mean, I think this is the kind of thing that we have to go beyond our, you know, traditional approach to the legislature. I don't think they're going to want to fund this, but I think that this is a very important issue to the public, and that so it is not in any way a criticism of what we're doing. It's really a call to others to join us in this mission.
I think that's a great idea. We've been looking at what few opportunities we do have right now, but I think reaching out to other organizations that may have an interest in this area is a good one.
Right. And you know, this is a compelling story you just told us. It's very positive, and yet it didn't touch on the fact that there are thousands. And so I think if there was a piece of this presentation as to how big the pile is and show how what it would take to actually really dent it over this remaining period of time that we have this authority, that would be helpful. Thank you. Commissioner Schaumburg.
Yes, I also want to thank the enforcement staff for this great presentation. You know, this is how we said it would work, but I never thought it would work this well and this rapidly. I think it's very exciting. And Commissioner Kinsey was talking about the number of open enforcement cases, but I'm curious whether or not this can be used in a case where there's an unpermitted use where you haven't actually opened an enforcement case. And my example to that is I don't know if it's still there, Pebble Beach had an unpermitted kiosk that clearly limited access, had a chilling effect on the public. And I don't know if there's an enforcement case opened or not, but I don't think so. Can it be used for that, or do you have to open an enforcement case to use this provision of law?
There's nothing requiring a formal opening of a case. What we do is we just open cases so that we can track progress and to keep track of it's a filing thing, but it's not a legal requirement at all. And in fact, we've been trying to open cases as quickly as possible for things. And things that occupy public beach are clearly, if they're unpermitted, are violations and could have a case opened. It's funny because we looked at a variety of things, partly to Chair Kinsey's question. We looked at a variety of ways to try to be more efficient, like doing form letters and things to quickly pump out. But the problem is you get the capacity at the other end. So I do want you to know that we're looking as creatively as possible as we can to do as much as we can with what we currently have. And the other thing, I wanted to know that we did talk about the overall case numbers in the staff report. We just didn't go over it in this public presentation because it's a less cheerful topic than the application of the access.
Well, thank you.
Certainly there's nothing requiring us to formally open a case for it to apply. And in fact, part of our motive in trying to get the word out about its applicability is that we wouldn't even have to open a case if somebody knew that we could come after them, that they could remove it voluntarily or not put it in the first place.
Well, in the case I mentioned, that's what I was hoping for. Thank you.
Yes, I'm sorry. What facility was that?
Talk to Dan. He knows. Okay. It's a kiosk, unpermitted kiosk in Pebble Beach.
Okay.
Commissioner Vargas, then Commissioner Cox.
Are we submitting violations to you right now? Because I got one too, right?
But seriously, we get them from commissioners and the public all the time. Please feel free to call us.
Corner of Broad Beach Road and Cottontail. Lachuza Beach. It's like I was saying the other day, my favorite beach to go to, and I love parking in front of this guy's no parking signs that he has. Illegal no parking signs in front of his house. So that was one thing. The other thing is to second Chairman Kinsey's thoughts that, you know, it'd be great if we can figure out a way to, you know, bring on some volunteers or pro bono attorneys or law students that can help, you know, under the supervision and management of our staff, obviously, but can help with the logjam to help us clear through this the backlog. So if there's any way you think you need our support to do that, or if that can just be worked out administratively, I think you'd find a lot of folks on the commission that would be very supportive of something like that. My other question, all kidding aside, how would a member of the public let you guys know? Is there an easy way to? Is there a tip line, or is there a? What could you kind of go give us a little bit of an explanation of what we tell folks, how they can report violations?
I should have brought up one of the pamphlets. They're outside on the table outside, and we sent them to most commissioners, and if you don't have copies, I'm happy to send you some. But on the back of that, it has the phone number for each of the districts, and it tells which counties it covers so they know who to contact, and those are the direct dial numbers of the enforcement staff. It's also available on our website. We don't have affirmative enforcement staff that go out and do monitoring. We are at the mercy of the eyes and ears of the public, and we get constant reports, and we're happy to get them.
If I were to say post violations, photos of violations on your Facebook, on the Coastal Commission Facebook page, or Twitter them to you guys, if we have a Twitter handle, would that be an acceptable thing to follow up on? Or
I think you could email them to me. Okay. I'd be happy to give you the...
I don't mean me personally. I mean folks, you know, the public. But if the best way to do it is through the phone line, that's fine. But it might be worth considering social media as an opportunity for people to shame. You know, you had a lot of folks drought shaming, and maybe this is a, you know, coastal hogging. We can have some type of shaming of that sort through social media is my suggestion.
We certainly are looking at ways to creatively use social media to get the word out. I mean, we do believe that since the public is now, and now that we have a PIO and we're working on a Facebook page, and we're coordinating with her and the senior management to try to figure out the ways to take advantage of that, because we really do want the public involved in these cases.
Thanks.
Commissioner Cox.
Mr. Chairman, when you made your comments, it got me thinking that I think we really have developed, through Charles's efforts, a good relationship with the League of California Cities and the California State Association of Counties. And it seems to me we've got, 76 cities in the coastal zone and 15 counties. Maybe that would be a good forum. I realize that we're the enforcement agency, but frankly, I would think the cities and counties have just as much interest in making sure that public access is preserved. And maybe there's a way that if there's an enforcement action that comes in to the Coastal Commission, that we could reach out to those cities and counties, and a lot of them have code enforcement officers, and it seems to me that's something that could be added, eyes and ears on the ground, and actually a workforce that I would think would have the same interest that we do, which is to preserve public access and to make sure that people are in compliance.
Commissioner Cox, absolutely. The irony is it sort of works the opposite. We have many, many cities and counties, and they are very supportive, and they are excellent and good partners with us. Even in locations where you might think that there's some dispute between the Coastal Commission staff and planning staff, the code enforcement folks work very well with us, and we have a good relationship. The problem is they have even fewer resources and expertise than do we. And they routinely refer things to us and say, please take action here. We would love to do something here. We think this is an important case, but we just simply can't staff it. So although we would love to find somebody else to give cases to, and we do work it out, and if it's something that they have an ongoing permit action that could resolve it or something, we do look for those opportunities. But very often we find that our brethren at the local government level are really in need of assistance.
Well, maybe if nothing else, maybe this is an issue that we could put on the agenda for the upcoming meeting we'll be having with representatives from the coastal cities and the coastal counties.
Yep. Thank you. Okay. Commissioner Howell.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey. I too just wanted to compliment you, Lisa, on your judicious use of your new authority. I think your staff are doing a great job. I had kind of a technical question.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the numbers of violations, are they based on the location, or I could see multiple violations on any given spot? Okay, so you've got a gate up and you have no parking. You're just bad. And there's a whole bunch of different ways that you are bad. Do those count as multiple violations, or are they one?
For purposes of penalties, they do count as separate violations. For purposes of counting the numbers of cases, we've lumped them together. So the numbers that we were giving you were numbers of locations with a group of violations. But Alex, I'll let counsel address the issue of how to calculate penalties.
Thank you.
So every case is going to have to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. It's hard to present a general rule for how you count the number of violations on a case. And when we start getting into doing actual penalty calculations, we'll have to make those determinations on a case-by-case basis. But certainly there is the possibility, as you suggest, that one site with various forms of impediments to public access could be counted as multiple violations.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thanks very much to
Thank
all
you.
Of you. And carry on.
Thank
and
you.
With that, we will move to another item that we trailed, I believe, our legislative report, or what would your preference be?
Our preference would be to move through Dan's items if we could, because there are members here to speak to some of those
okay.
members of the public, if that's okay.
Fine. Absolutely. So we'll move to our North Central Coast Deputy Director's report. Welcome back, Dan Carl.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey. Yes, that does bring us to the Deputy Director's report for North Central, item number 5. Today we're reporting one emergency coastal permit. There's not a need for commission concurrence, so unless there's any questions, we'll just move on with the rest of the agenda.
Yes. Any unwillingness for concurrence? We will.
Thank you. We don't have anything on the consent calendar. We do have on the appeal calendar item number 7A. We have a PowerPoint for this one.
And this will be a substantial issue and as well. Is that correct?
This would be an SI and a de novo, yes.
Yes. Okay.
So item 7A is an appeal of a City of Half Moon Bay coastal permit decision for a two-lot subdivision seaward of Highway 1 in Half Moon Bay. We are in agreement on the staff recommendation with both the applicant and the appellants, and thus this will be a very short presentation. Next slide, please. So slide number 2 shows you the location of the site west of Highway 1 in Half Moon Bay and identifies the existing parcel in purple on the right. It's a long rectangular property that was once part of the railroad right-of-way in this area. Next slide, please. The city-approved project would create two parcels from one, as seen in slide 3. The two new parcels created are referred to as Parcel A, which is the southern residentially zoned parcel, and Parcel B, which is the northern parcel that is partly zoned urban reserve and partly zoned open space. The appellants contend that the project raises substantial issues related to public access and traffic, and we concur. The parcel is just inland of Half Moon Bay State Beach and Francis Beach Campground that you can see in the left in this slide, and is served by Kelly Avenue, which is an LCP-designated public access point. Without adequate safeguards on the newly created parcels, we believe there's the potential for adverse public access impacts, including related to traffic, associated with future development on the new parcels. Because staff's recommending substantial issue, unless three or more commissioners request an SI hearing, substantial issue will be deemed found and will move into the de novo review.
I do not see three hands going up, so let's move right into de novo, assuming that and accepting that we have a substantial issue.
Thank you. In de novo review, we did work closely with the applicant to resolve potential issues with future development. Primarily, this involves adding restrictions to Parcel B to ensure that only allowable public access and open space development would occur in the future and not residential development. In that way, the applicant is allowed residential development on the residentially zoned portion of the property involved, but the LCP requirements relating to the other zoning districts are also upheld, and potential future impacts from inappropriate development are extinguished. So as indicated earlier, we're in agreement on the staff recommendation with both the applicant and the appellants. Next slide, please. Thus, we're recommending approval with conditions, and the motion is the second motion on page 5 of the staff report, and that concludes our presentation.
Thank you. Are there any ex partes on this? No. Any speaker cards? No. Commissioner Groom.
Thank you. I move that the commission approve coastal development permit number A2HMB 150040 pursuant to the staff recommendation, and I recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Would you care to speak to this?
No, but the letters in the file are from Mr. Hamilton says that he has agrees to all these conditions.
Thank you. And to your second? Okay. Any unwillingness for unanimous yes vote? With that, then, we do hereby approve the coastal development permit for this project. Thank you.
Thank you. Item number 7B was postponed earlier. That one, just all the parties were interested in spending a little more time working on the issue, so that will return at a future date. That brings us to the Central Coast calendar and the Central Coast Deputy Director's Report, item 8. Today we're reporting 7 waivers, 2 immaterial amendments, 2 extensions, and 1 emergency permit. I do note that we received several comments about one of the waivers, namely the waiver to install a stormwater treatment unit in the city of Pacific Grove. As far as we can tell, the majority of the concerns are related to a prior part of the project that involved using Greenwood Park as a wetland retention area. The city actually dropped that part of the project, and that's the project that's the subject of the waiver is only to install an engineered stormwater treatment device in the road to better address water quality in Pacific Grove, including in terms of the offshore marine protected area. We continue to believe the project's a good one, and it's really a fairly standard type of water quality improvement project with which the commission's familiar. So we continue to recommend the waiver there. As to the others, I'm not aware of any objections or controversy with those items, and so we're looking for the commission's concurrence on all of them.
Thank you. Any questions? Any unwillingness for unanimous concurrence? We will concur. We're going to want to have a very brief break, and commissioners, if you keep it brief, you get out earlier, but it's okay. I think we'll just take 5 minutes right now, and then we'll carry on. We are now back in session, and we are on the Central Coast with Dan Carl.
Yes, and before we leave the Deputy Director's report, Dr. Lester has something he wanted to add.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey and Commissioners. I just wanted to report as part of Dan's Director's report that with respect to the SNG matter, which we had on the agenda a few months back in a dispute resolution, the result of that was a continuation of that item and a request that I be involved in meetings directly with Mr. Gondor and the applicant to bring that to resolution. I just wanted to report that I have participated in 3 or maybe 4, I can't recall, 4 meetings since that time, and staff has had a number of other meetings and numerous communications and reviewing of materials, and we have reached agreements on the conditions. We are still awaiting the submittal of materials from Mr. Gondor and his team to confirm the implementation of those agreements, but assuming that happens, that would lead to the issuance of the permit. So I just wanted to report that to you today. And assuming those materials do that, I don't anticipate you would be seeing this in a dispute resolution. So.
Well, maybe we better take another break just to celebrate. Okay, thank you. Carry on, Dan.
Okay, thank you. That will bring us to item number 10A on the local coastal program calendar, and this is a Santa Cruz County LCP amendment. It's designed to modify LCP rezoning rules associated with affordable housing. We work really closely with the county on some minor changes to ensure that coastal resources, including coastal priority uses, are adequately protected through the amendment, and the county's in agreement with the recommendation. Importantly, a future amendment would be necessary before any coastal zone property would be rezoned into the subject housing district, and thus the commission will have an opportunity at that time to help assess what level of density and or development would be appropriate in any particular case. So the commission needs to take two actions to affect the staff recommendation, one to deny as submitted, and one to approve with modifications. And the motions for each are found on page 3 of the staff report. That concludes our presentation.
Thank you. Any ex partes on this? No public speaking cards on this. Commissioner Groom.
I move the commission reject implementation plan major amendment number LCP3-SCO-15008-1 Part B and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
I'd like to speak to your motion?
No.
Or your second? Any opposition to unanimous yes vote? Okay, that motion passes and move to the...
I move that the commission certify implementation plan major amendment number LCP3-SCO-15008-1 Part B and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Any unwillingness for unanimous yes vote? Okay, then we do approve that.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey. That'll bring us to the appeal calendar and item number 11A. We do have a PowerPoint for this one. So 11A is an appeal of a Monterey County decision allowing a seawall to protect a cypress tree in the Del Monte Forest area of Monterey County. The LCP, similar to the Coastal Act, only allows such armoring to protect existing structures and coastal-dependent uses in danger from erosion. The cypress tree doesn't qualify as either of these, and the project raises other issues in terms of impacting ESHA and public views. So we're recommending the commission find substantial issue. Thus, unless three or more commissioners would like to debate that question, it will be found, and we'd proceed into the de novo phase of the hearing. Prior to asking the question, I'd also note the applicant has invoked the right to postpone should the commission find substantial issue, and thus the de novo portion of the hearing would be postponed to a future hearing if SI is found today.
Thank you. Before we see if three or more commissioners want to discuss substantial issue, I want to just confirm a procedural question. We have a speaker card for the applicants asking to be able to testify on substantial issues. So for that to happen, it would require that three or more commissioners would express an interest.
Yes, the commission's practice has been that when commission staff is recommending substantial issue, that the commission, individual commissioners may ask questions at that phase, but unless three or more commissioners wish to have a full hearing on the issue of substantial issue is presumed. But if three or more would like to have the SI hearing,
we could do that. As an alternative, if in my capacity as chair, if I wanted to invite this individual up and ask him a question before we determined whether commission wanted to take it, that would be acceptable?
Yes, the regulations do allow for commissioners to ask questions at this stage.
Well, with the indulgence of my commission, I'd like to give Mr. Bridges the opportunity and ask him to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. John Bridges on behalf of Mr. Reed.
My question to you is, why did you travel all this way, and what would you like to say in less than 3 minutes?
Afforded 3 minutes, I will share that with you, sir.
Please.
With the indulgence of the commission, thank you. I just wanted to mention on the substance with regard to the substantial issue question that we believe that Monterey County's findings approving this project 8 years ago as a protection, restoration, and enhancement measure for shoreline habitat consistent with land use plan policies 8 and 26 were well-founded and appropriate in this case. Not only is this tree itself ESHA, but it is also a benefit in the spring to the spring seal pupping that happens on this pocket beach, and it also enhances the public view from this dedicated Cypress Point public viewing area from certain vantage points by screening Mr. Reed's house from the public. Coastal geologist Gary Griggs, who you are familiar with, has confirmed that during the 8 years that the temporary sandbags have been in place and protecting the tree, no harm whatsoever has been occasioned to the resource, the beach, or any other resource. And Mr. Griggs has actually recommended that the sandbags just be left in place. If you're not comfortable with a permanent solution, leaving the sandbags in place is not going to harm anything. Finally, procedurally, so those are my comments regarding substantial issue. If you do determine substantial issue, we have requested postponement of the de novo hearing. We have requested a postponement to the December date because that's in San Francisco. It's more convenient for Mr. Reed to appear. We don't believe there's any rush to move this forward. It's been sitting idle for 8 years. And we waived time, obviously, within the 49 days, and we've been kind of waiting for each other to get back to each other. So no finger-pointing or fault-finding there. But we would prefer a December date. Staff has informed us that they would recommend October. I don't think anything big is going to happen in the 2 months between October and December that hasn't happened over the last 8 years. So we would appreciate your indulgence in a continuance to the December hearing. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. So this is to the matter of substantial issue. If three or more commissioners want to hear the matter of substantial issue, we could raise our hand. If not, then substantial issue will be found. And seeing that there are not hands being raised, I think we'll find substantial issue. And with that, at the request of the applicant, we'll postpone the de novo hearing to a future date. We've heard the expression of interest in December. We are also meeting in San Mateo County in November. So it seems to me that perhaps that would be better than October when we're back in Long Beach for just convenience to the applicant. But we'll leave that to the staff to resolve the timing. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey. That will bring us to item number 11B, and we also have a PowerPoint for this item. So item 11B is an appeal of a Monterey County action allowing an irrigation well intended to be used to irrigate residential landscaping for a home in the Carmel Highlands area of Monterey County. I'll note that there was an addendum that was distributed earlier on this matter responding to applicant's latest correspondence. Next slide, please. Slide 2 shows the project location inland from Yankee Point in the Carmel Highlands area, with the main residential portion of the applicant's property noted with a white circle on the aerial on the right. The applicant's property sits on a ridge and includes substantial areas of Esha all around, including coastal sage scrub, specifically sea cliff buckwheat, that is habitat for the federally endangered Smith's blue butterfly. All of the property located outside of the main developed area is deed restricted in perpetuity to protect this Esha and subject to an HCP that was put into effect when the house was developed a decade or so ago. Next slide, please. So here on slide 3, you can see a blow up of the main residential portion of the property. In the slide, you can make out the large areas of lawn that are adjacent to the residence. The proposed well would be located in the driveway area that appears somewhat white in this photo in the upper right-hand corner of that white area. Next slide, please. And so slide 4 shows you the overall project site, and the inset shot is similar to the last slide, again showing the proposed project, and you can see the well location noted there. Next slide, please. The residence receives its water from the appellant, the Carmel Riviera Mutual Water Company, who contends that the approved project is inconsistent with numerous policies and standards in the LCP, including those related to noticing water supply and intensification of water use, Esha, erosion and geologic hazards, and public health and safety. The appellant also contends that there are existing violations on the property relating to tree removal and the planting of unpermitted, non-native, and non-drought-tolerant vegetation on the site, inconsistent with the original approval in the HCP. So staff's recommending that these allegations raise a substantial issue, and we'd normally ask whether three or more commissioners would like to have that substantial issue hearing before proceeding. In this case, however, since the primary point of contention raised by the applicant concerns matters associated with the appellant standing to appeal at all, we'd recommend that the commission hold the substantial issue hearing to allow that question to be more fully evaluated. And so we are looking for three commissioners to want to hold that substantial issue hearing. Thank you. So we'll proceed with the SI hearing. Next slide, please. In terms of the standing to appeal, the Coastal Act and the LCP require potential appellants to gain standing through participation in the local process, including exhausting local appeal processes in certain circumstances, or through a demonstration of good cause for why they didn't. In this case, the appellant did not participate in that way locally, but the evidence in the record indicates there's a valid good cause argument as to why they didn't. First, the LCP requires a mailed notice to local agencies that are expected to provide services to the project. The appellant would need to install and service backflow devices for the well, evidencing a need to provide such services. However, the appellant was not mailed a notice. Second, the LCP requires that at least three notices be posted where they are publicly accessible and visible to the public. In this case, the applicant posted three notices, all of which were located on Mentone Drive, a private road, and on the applicant's private property, and all of which were located past a sign that stated private road, no trespassing. These notices were not publicly accessible or visible. Thus, these notices do not suffice as adequate public notice under the LCP. Finally, the applicant and the appellant have provided differing accounts of other times when Carmel Riviera employees might have seen the notices that were posted were not accessible to the public. As best as we can tell, the applicant has not shown that the appellant was provided notice in this way. This is all covered in some detail in the staff report on pages 7 through 10. In our view, the noticing didn't meet LCP requirements and raises a substantial issue. Next slide, please. In addition to the noticing issues, the project raises a series of substantial issues in our view related to LCP requirements for water supply and water use, as well as ESHA and hazard issues. At its core, this is an irrigation project to support non-native landscaping where such landscaping isn't even allowed during a period of extended drought, and it's not supportable by the LCP. Next slide, please. Thus, we recommend the Commission find that the approved project raises a series of substantial LCP issues and that it take jurisdiction over the coastal permit application. Should that occur following public hearing and your deliberations, then we'll proceed with the de novo portion of the hearing. So that concludes our SI presentation.
Okay, thank you. We have speaker cards from Mr. Bridges, and also we have Jacqueline here as well. Mr. Bridges, come forward. Each side will have 3 minutes.
Thank you, and again, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is John Bridges. I'm here speaking on behalf of the applicants. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you on the substantial issue question, and this is a threshold jurisdictional question before you this morning. The appellant is not an aggrieved party in accordance with Coastal Commission Rule 13111 in that they did not exhaust their local appeals. Without such standing to bring this appeal, there can be no substantial issue found and no jurisdiction available to the Coastal Commission. The appellant seeks relief from the standard or usual exhaustion requirement by pointing to Rule 13573, but this does not apply in this case because this rule is focused on county procedures. The county procedures here in this case clearly comply with the Coastal Commission or the Coastal Commission regulation notice procedures. In fact, they exceed those procedures. This is not a situation, this exception is not a situation that addresses project-specific, site-specific, which tree did you post the notice on kinds of questions. That is a question for the jurisdiction of Monterey County, not the Coastal Commission. In any event, the notice in this case was posted on a street or a road that is accessible by recorded unfettered access easement to the appellant. So for purposes of this appellant in this case, this notice is as available to them as it would have been on any public road. In fact, all of the roads in the Carmel Highlands are private, and notices are routinely posted on these private roads. Furthermore, the appellant had actual knowledge during the notice period. Appellant's workers and employees were accessing the road to work on their water tanks and actually literally had to touch the door upon which the notice was posted in order to use the electricity from our pump house. In response to the staff's addendum report, the staff is now suggesting that there might be another exception available here rather than 13573, and that would be the good cause exception. A good cause exception should be very carefully considered and only rarely granted because the exhaustion requirements are established for the protection of an applicant and the applicant's property rights. In this case, the only evidence presented is a single declaration based primarily on a lack of knowledge
And again, as I mentioned to you, the appellant does have unfettered access right to the road. Moreover, no mailed notice was required in this case because the water company won't provide any services to our well. The backflow issue is a non-issue because the backflow concern can and will be addressed by separate and independent plumbing. Regarding the intent of the Coastal Act to facilitate and encourage public participation, we would agree, but that participation in a case where we have a certified LCP belongs at the county level first. Simply put, there is no excuse for an exception to the exhaustion requirement. If notwithstanding the plain language of the law and the facts and the evidence before you today, the commission decides nevertheless to find substantial issue, we would respectfully request that the de novo hearing be continued to a time sufficiently in advance of this date so that we can take the standing question to the Superior Court and get a legal judgment rendered. Thank you.
Thank you. And now I'd like to invite up Jacqueline Ziske. You will also have 3 minutes.
Yes, my name is Jackie Ziske here on behalf of Carmel Ribeiro Mutual Water Company. I do have a slideshow. Can we get that put up on the screen? And this really was prepared for a de novo hearing, so I'll just flip through a few slides to give you an idea of what we're doing here. Hold on. We're going to be scrolling pretty. Yeah, got it. Here we go. Okay. It's a little, does this go on your screens too?
Uh-huh.
Okay, great. So it's a little difficult to tell, but on the far right, that's the applicant's proposed well site. And as commission staff was explaining, the well sits on top of a ridge. You'll see some notations where well 2 and 3 is located. It's at the bottom of the ridge on one side of the canyon, and then the other well that Carmel Riviera has is on the other side, well number 9. The CIP section that governs public notice requirements is 28404A2. That is the section that requires mailed notice to have been provided to Carmel Riviera Mutual Water Company. Mr. Bridges just indicated that mailed notice may not have been required because we will not be providing service to the irrigation well itself. But mailed notice is required because Carmel Riviera does have to provide services in order for the operation of that irrigation well. Notably, there would be there's a cross connection. There's a water quality concern about water backflowing into the Riviera system, and there would be services required to make sure that wouldn't happen. The second notice requirement requires public notice be posted in 3 public places. Staff indicated all 3 of these notices were posted behind a no trespassing sign on the applicant's private property. You do have declarations in the staff report. Carmel Riviera staff, head of operations, we did not know about this hearing. And had we known, we would have been there. This is just to show you where the no trespassing sign is. I don't know if you took if you took notice of this in your staff report, but shortly after the appeal was filed, they removed those no trespassing signs to try and avoid the fact that they improperly posted notice. As a legal matter, an aggrieved person, and I think John Bridges just acknowledged that the Coastal Commission does have discretion to find good cause for our inability to appear before the county, and we respectfully request that you do find that good cause exists and you let this matter go to a de novo hearing. I got 15 seconds, so I will show you one of the issues. This is some damage that occurred with the landslide on the site. Those are our facilities that got destroyed. That sits right below the subject property.
Thank you. Okay, bring it back.
I have a quick observation, and then I'm going to pass it to Mr. Peterson. The applicant has requested on the mic this morning that the de novo be postponed should the commission find substantial issue. The applicant's already exercised their right for their postponement. This is covered in the addendum that was distributed earlier. So we're prepared to do the de novo portion of the hearing. We don't see a reason to postpone at this point in time.
Thank you.
I'll pass to Mr. Peterson now.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carl. So the applicant has argued that the appellant does not have standing for this appeal because the appellant, everybody agrees that the appellant did not participate in the local government's review procedures. And it is true that normally, in order to have standing to appeal, an appellant must first have made its concerns known to the local government during the local government's CDP review process. Section 30801 of the Coastal Act, however, does expressly allow exceptions when an appellant had good cause for not having done so. Now, under the Commission's regulations, they provide that normally an appellant needs to have exhausted their local remedies before they can appeal. There are some exceptions to that requirement. One of those exceptions is when the appellant was denied the right of local appeal because local notice and hearing procedures for the development did not comply with the requirements in our regs regarding local notice procedures. The appellant has argued that simply refers to whether or not the procedures that are in the LCP comply with the regulations, the Commission's regulations, and that it does not extend to whether the procedures that were actually followed on a particular project satisfied those compliance with those requirements. I would disagree with that interpretation. The regulation does specifically refer to the procedures for the development. So I think it's appropriate for the Commission to consider whether the notice requirements that are in the LCP were followed. So in terms of the specific LCP requirements, the LCP does require mailed notice to services districts when they're provided to provide a service for a particular project. And the appellants and the applicants have provided different statements just now about whether the utility services district would be required to provide a service. My understanding, but I'll defer to Dan, to Mr. Carl on this, is that the utility services district would be required to provide certain kinds of services for the well to go into operation. In addition to those requirements regarding compliance with the local noticing procedures, the regulations do not limit the Commission's discretion to find that good cause exists for not having participated in the local process. It does not limit good cause simply to failure to comply with the local noticing requirements. So the Commission, on the basis of the record before it, does have discretion to determine whether good cause exists in this instance. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Lester?
I just wanted to add, we're very confident in our recommendation here and what happened, but to the extent there might be any uncertainty, the 30006 of the Coastal Act does ask us to provide for maximum, the widest opportunity for public participation in our procedures, and then 30009 asks us to construe our Coastal Act liberally to affect its purposes. So, you know, in this case, we think the recommendation that there is not a standing issue here is the right one, and that we should proceed with the substantial issue.
Thank you. Commissioner Groom.
I move the Commission determine that Appeal Number A3-MCO-15-0023 raises no substantial issue with respect to the grounds on which the appeal has been filed under Section 30603 of the Coastal Act and recommend a no vote.
Second.
Care to speak to your motion or your second? So we have a motion for no substantial issue, and the makers of the motion are requesting a no vote. Is there any unwillingness for a unanimous no vote? And we do find substantial issue, and then the issue of the de novo hearing, I'll come back to Commissioner Groom, because the applicant has requested a postponement. You've notified us that a postponement isn't their right. Commissioner Groom, did you want to make a comment?
Well, I think, Mr. Carl, since he's requested a postponement, does it throw us off kilter too much to grant that? I mean, he's requested one.
They requested a postponement from the prior hearing when we had this all scheduled. So the report and much of it, the analysis, has been out and available for them to consider for months. We think we're prepared. Both the applicant and the appellant are here represented, and we don't see a need to push it out any further. We don't see that we'd gain anything.
Do you know why the applicant is requesting a postponement?
He did.
Can I just add that there is a workload associated with the postponement and your time, importantly. We have time right now. We may or may not have a lot of time next month or the month after that.
Right. In addition, I would point out that the applicant said that the reason they were seeking the postponement was to go to court, and the reality is they're going to be able to go to court over the action that we take. If they're not satisfied with it, it wouldn't be any more or less of a matter. So unless there's strong concern about proceeding, I think we could proceed with a de novo hearing at this time.
Okay. Can we go back to the staff PowerPoint? And if we could go to slide number 9. So in terms of the de novo portion of the hearing, for us, this is a fairly straightforward project. It's clear to us that it's not approvable under the LCP. It doesn't meet the LCP test for allowing a water supply use. It's not addressed the habitat issues associated with the site and the surrounding area, including in terms of the HCP. There are potentially geologic hazard issues unresolved. In addition, the project was not noticed properly and cannot be approved when a violation is pending under Monterey County's LCP. To us, this is a good example of a project that shouldn't have been approved in the first place. The applicant has a water connection and has access to water for their use, including their irrigation needs. A better project under the LCP would be one that removed the high water use and not allowed lawn and related ornamental landscaping areas and looked at ways to address water use differently in light of the drought and the effect of a project like this on water supplies. Next slide, please. Thus, we recommend that the Commission deny the application. The motion is found on page 4 of the staff report, and it's the second motion shown there. That concludes our presentation. So now, Chair Kinsey, public hearing. Now we move into the public hearing.
Yes, please. With the public hearing, then, I assume that each of the speakers wants
the same. Yeah.
Are there any ex partes? Then the applicant could come forward. And how much time would you like for your presentation, Mr. Bridges?
I would appreciate 10 minutes on the front end and then an opportunity for rebuttal, if that's allowable.
Sure. That would be available. So 10 minutes and 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. That'd be great.
Okay. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, good morning, Commissioners. John Bridges on behalf of the applicants. I'd like to start by asking us to step back from the trees and see the forest. I want to talk about what this project is, what this well is, and what this well isn't. And I think that's an important threshold question. This is a simple landscape irrigation well. This is not a new domestic water system. This is not a potable water system. This is not going to compete or conflict in any way with Riviera's ongoing operation and service to its customers. And in fact, my client is a customer of Riviera. They don't want to do anything that's going to undermine or jeopardize
their potable domestic service. This is simply an irrigation well, and thus and therefore the policies that are discussed in the staff report about non-proliferation of domestic water systems where there already is one in existence are just simply not relevant here. This is a simple landscape irrigation well. Why are we applying for a landscape irrigation well? Well, originally we were applying for the well because there was, in fact, lawn and ornamental planting on the site. That was planted by the preceding owner. My client did not know that that was not consistent with the county-approved landscape plan. As soon as they were informed, they immediately began removing the lawn. Staff showed you a picture that they know is quite outdated. We submitted to staff a more recent picture. I don't have an overhead projector here, but much of the lawn has, in fact, been removed. Staff has this in their record. It was submitted to staff. And that portion of lawn that remains is scheduled to be removed and replaced with drought-tolerant native grasses consistent with the county-approved landscape plan. So why do we need an irrigation well for that kind of landscape? Because drought-tolerant doesn't mean it doesn't need water. It's a large piece of property. We want to maintain our landscape for fire protection purposes and various other things. We want to maintain it in a healthy way. So it's a legitimate request for the well. Staff complains that we have not demonstrated to their satisfaction that the well will not adversely impact Riviera's wells or Malpaso Creek. And that is true because we can't demonstrate it. We can't demonstrate anything until we have a well in order to conduct protocol tests. And that's what you do. You construct your well and then you conduct your protocol testing to determine if there's any connection at all between the well and Riviera's wells and or Malpaso Creek. And we have volunteered to engage in those tests in accordance with protocols that are standard and or additional protocols that are requested by the staff and or Riviera. We're happy to sit down and discuss those protocols. We want you to consider our well on the basis of facts and not speculation that it might have an adverse impact. We actually want to deal in science. We want to deal in facts. If after those tests, and in fact we actually discussed this with Riviera early on in our settlement discussions, and they expressed some concern about the timing of a protocol test. Normally that's done in the dry season, and we said, and they expressed concern that a dry season well test in and of itself might actually impact their wells. And we said, okay, we'll do a wet season test. That's not normal protocol, but it's certainly adequate protocol for determining connectivity between the wells. We have engaged the services of a professional hydrogeologist, Aaron Bierman, who's the go-to guy in Monterey, very familiar with the Highlands, very familiar with all of Monterey County, frankly. And we asked him, we said, Aaron, will you draft up some conditions and some protocols that will ensure that Carmel's Riviera's wells won't be affected? In other words, after we do the test, if there's no connection between the wells, there's no concern and there's no issue. If there is some connectivity between the wells, then we would invite conditions and mitigations to ensure that our well will be subordinate to theirs and that, in fact, there will be no adverse impacts to Riviera's wells nor any adverse impacts to Malpaso Creek. We presented those kinds of conditions and mitigations with those ultimate and important criteria, i.e., no impact and subordination, to staff and to Riviera. Staff got back and said, you're lacking specificity. Our hydrologist did the best he could. We would invite an opportunity. We would ask for an opportunity to sit down with staff in Riviera and define the specificity that they're looking for. Define the testing protocol, and if connectivity is found, define with specificity satisfactory to staff and Riviera how we can limit and restrict the use of our landscape irrigation well so as not to adversely impact their well. Their well provides domestic services to a lot of people, including us. In fact, if you really think about it, again, at that hovering 10,000-foot level, if we use our well for irrigation purposes, we're not going to be drawing potable water from Riviera's system to irrigate our landscape. We're actually going to enhance the availability of potable water for domestic purposes by not drawing from that system for purposes of landscape irrigation. There have been standing ovations for just down the street, Pebble Beach Company's tertiary treatment plant, a very complicated project where they use non-potable water for the irrigation of their golf courses. This is a micro-mini example, similar in my opinion. We're using non-potable water to irrigate landscape and thereby relieving the burden or the draw from a domestic system for those purposes. We would like the opportunity to demonstrate There is no pending violation at this point in time. As I mentioned to you, as soon as we learned the prior owner's landscaping was not consistent with the county's, we have begun the process, substantially completed the process, but not entirely, of removing those lawn areas and the ornamental landscaping. So there's no pending violation that creates a problem for this permit. We'd like that opportunity to demonstrate factually and scientifically whether or not this well is connected, and if it is, to, with specificity satisfactory to staff and Riviera, define conditions that will ensure subordination of our well so that there would be no adverse impact to Riviera or Mel Paso Creek. Staff also mentions that the Coastal Act calls for careful and conservative water planning, and I believe that this project is an example of careful and conservative water planning. We are taking ourselves off of, at significant expense, the domestic system and reliance on the domestic system for our landscape irrigation, and instead relying upon our own water to accomplish that goal in a manner with conditions that we are inviting that will not adversely affect the domestic system. So we would like that opportunity to sit down with staff and sit down with Riviera and work out, first of all, find out if there's an issue based on scientific fact and not just speculation, and then work out the conditions with the specificity required and desired. With that, that's far less than 10. Good for me. That doesn't happen very often. Appreciate your indulgence and your consideration. I would like to have an opportunity to respond to public comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you have any questions, of course, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you.
Jackie Ziske. And you'll have 3 minutes.
How much time do I have?
You have 3 minutes.
Oh, I have 3 minutes. Okay. I'm going to skip the presentation then, and just the visual, and just go right to the points. Our experts looked at the various mitigation measures and conditions that were proposed by the property owner, and we could not come up with a way of securing the viability of the of our water system, and I'll outline some of those problems for you. One is the Carmel Riviera wells are located right below the applicant's property. Water flows downhill. To go through all this extensive testing to say there might not be a connection, we know there's a connection there. That's where we get our water supply from. The drilling of an irrigation well by itself, too, there is a complexity in looking at fractures in bedrock. If you drill a well in bedrock, you could feasibly break some of those fractures that are leading water to our wells. So we're really concerned about that as well. Pumping tests take a lot of water. So if they want to do a pump test, that's water that we need. And I don't think anyone really understands how much water a 72-hour pump test uses up. Another problem is the Bierman proposal uses a threshold of significance of 5%. We can't have any impact to our wells right now. As shown in the declaration of our operations manager, we are using those three bedrock wells concurrently. Normally, we don't even use them, and then when we need them, we use them on an alternating basis. We are running those things concurrently right now. We need that water. Wet weather pump tests, our experts are telling us those are unreliable. We can't rely on that. That's not acceptable to the water company. And I have a problem with enforceability. This applicant has violated so many conditions that have been imposed on his property, so many deed restrictions that they were supposed to have had a landscape plan already in place on that property. They were restricted to having native landscaping, and you saw pictures of the extensive lawns. Any kind of monitoring and enforcement involved with trying to appease this gentleman to putting a proposed well on his site, I don't know how we could monitor and make sure it would be enforceable. We're really concerned with that. So thank you for your time.
Bring it back to Mr. Bridges and then to staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, members of the Commission, John Bridges. This will be fairly short. Just to the points that Ms. Zichke raised, I'll respond to those. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, their concern about potential impacts to their well system is not fact-based. It is speculative. I'm actually surprised that Ms. Zichke said or is relying on the adage that water runs downhill. That is an unscientific statement. When we're dealing with fractured rock aquifers, there is no way at all to determine connectivity without doing official protocoled pump testing to determine whether or not their well system is connected to ours. That's just a simple scientific fact. That's what we are absolutely willing to do. We're asking for the opportunity to do that so that we can deal in facts and not in speculation. She expressed concern again about the testing and the timing of the testing. We've agreed to do no dry season testing. We will test that well during the wet season when there is no potential for impact. 72-hour pump tests are very common. They are very standard. They are protocol. We will do it during the wet season, no risk to their wells. And the wet season tests, according to Mr. Bierman, will adequately and scientifically establish whether there's any connectivity between the wells. Ms. Zichke expressed concern about the significance threshold of a 5% drawdown or saturation level. That is the standard of significance employed and applied by the Monterey County Health Department. If that is a significance threshold that is of concern during drought time conditions, we can certainly reduce that significance threshold to a lower number for greater assurance. Again, the ultimate goal, the ultimate criteria for conditions on the well, if there is connectivity, is to ensure that there is no adverse impact on Three Rivieres wells or Malpaso Creek. We can address the specificity of that threshold that was included in Mr. Bierman's report because that is the standard threshold criteria employed by the Monterey County Health Department. My clients have not violated a single condition associated with their property or the permit. As I mentioned to you, they purchased the property with landscaping that had been planted by their predecessor. We have learned that that was not consistent with the county landscape plan, and we are actually working to remedy that problem. We are not violators. We are fixers, and we are trying to do that. In fact, we want to maintain the landscape in a healthy way by using our landscape irrigation well. Finally, with regard to the need to monitor permit conditions, that is standard fare. All coastal development permits have conditions and mitigations, and they are consistently monitored by Monterey County and your enforcement agency and ARM, which now has greater authority than it, well, I guess that's public access, sorry. But the Coastal Act provides plenty of support and security for implementing and monitoring condition compliance. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Now we'll bring it back to the staff.
Just a couple of quick things. Mr. Bridges has indicated in his initial discussion that the LCP policies don't apply, referencing this as a water system and that we were using the policies incorrectly. Water systems include wells, and in our view, we just disagree with him as to what the LCP means in terms of the policies and the way that they apply to this project. I can point you to, including on page 17 of the staff report, where that's called out in the policies. As to the tests and the mitigations that have now been proposed by the applicant, we also don't agree that that resolves the issues, particularly related to the LCP policies. It's covered in some detail in the addendum on page 2 of the addendum, so I won't go into that unless there are questions later. I would note the water purveyor, and Ms. Zichke said this, doesn't agree with the applicant on this point, and that indicates that even the tests would lead to adverse impacts to their water supply. As to the lawn removal, that's good news from our perspective, that the lawn's being removed and they're going to put in the drought-tolerant plants that were required originally. And then just closing, in our view, this is this kind of a project sets a bad precedent, wrong kind of incentives, especially during a drought. We're not looking to see a proliferation of private irrigation wells into the public commons, and we just don't even think it's approvable under the LCP as we've indicated in the staff report. So with that, we're available for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? I have a question. I'd like to ask Ms. Ziske come forward. Thank you.
It's like whiskey with a Z, Ziske.
Ziske.
Yeah.
Okay. Two questions to you. Is the applicant, he stated that the applicant is a customer of the Mutual Water Company, is that correct?
That is correct.
And would the Mutual Water Company be able to provide irrigation water to its customers?
Right now, we have conservation rates. We have a tiered rate structure. We have not instituted rationing on our customers yet, because we don't know where we're going. But since 2013, we've had a 26% reduction in water use in our system because of the conservation efforts. So we do have, for example, you know, this one owner irrigating.
Right, but in the absence of the use of that irrigation well, the Mutual Water Company does provide the opportunity for its customers to use water for landscape irrigation.
Yes.
And then secondly, is yours a district with a defined boundary for the boundary of the water district, the Mutual Water District?
We have a service area.
Service area.
Correct.
And do you not have any regulation that prohibits customers within your service area from independently developing wells?
Well, we do have bylaws, and those bylaws do specifically set forth a priority for water use for domestic. Domestic has priority.
But they don't preclude individuals from seeking permits for irrigation wells?
Our bylaws do not.
Thank you. Okay, those were my questions.
I was just going to add on that last question, and it is on page 17 of the staff report. The LCP does specifically speak to avoiding the proliferation of these sorts of systems into areas where the boundaries of existing water systems, and this is subsection F at the bottom of page 17. Right. So the LCP does speak exactly to your question.
Thank you. Commissioner Grimm?
I move the commission approve coastal development permit number A3-MCO-15-0023 for the development proposed by the applicant and ask for a no vote.
Would you like to speak to your motion?
No.
Or your seconds?
No.
Any further comment? Any unwillingness for a unanimous no vote? With that, then, we do deny that permit. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kinsey. Almost done here.
Yeah.
Item 11C, as I indicated earlier, this one was an appeal associated with the Harbor Terrace Visitor Serving Project at Port San Luis in the Avila Beach area, but the appeal's been withdrawn, so there won't be a hearing on the item. I would like to make two quick notes about this project. First, your staff worked very closely with the Port District, State Coastal Conservancy staff, county staff, and a variety of interested parties for many years on this project to ensure LCP consistency. It's a new visitor-serving project that includes a low-cost camping component that itself comes from a very specific LCP amendment adopted by this commission in 2006. It's a very significant project that will greatly enhance visitor-serving amenities and public recreational access amenities at Port San Luis, and we're excited to see it come to fruition. Secondly, the appeal was focused on issues associated with the nearby fish cleaning station at Hartford Pier, and I'd note that the appellant, the Port District, and other interested groups and parties have decided to work together outside of the appeal process to bring about meaningful change there, and we're going to continue to support and encourage those efforts. So I just wanted to provide that little snippet about why, or that project. That done then does bring us to the administrative calendar and item number 12A. And this is an amendment to a prior coastal permit allowing a fireworks display in Capitola for the next 5 years. The amendment includes all of the same parameters to ensure coastal resource protection as the base permit, and we believe it appropriately addresses such issues. So unless one-third or more of the commission requests that it be scheduled for a public hearing at a later date, it will be approved as recommended. In other words, we're looking for your concurrence on that administrative calendar.
Any questions? Any unwillingness for concurrence? So we do concur with that. Okay. That would bring us up to our legislative report, which we trailed to this day.
Welcome, right, Chair. And Sarah is here to assist with that, and I think she handed out, you should have a short staff recommendation addressing the concern that was raised the other day and was trailed to today.
Good morning, Commissioners. I did hand out an analysis of SB 798 pursuant to your discussions about this bill on Wednesday when the legislative report was initially presented to you. I would say it's been a relatively quiet month in Sacramento since the legislature's been on break. You do have a full legislative report that Charles started to present to you on Wednesday. If you have any questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. But in the interest of time, I think we'll go straight to the question of SB 798. So this is a committee bill. The commission's familiar with it. We've discussed it various times throughout this year. It's a bill that was introduced by the Senate Natural Resources Committee, chaired by Fran Pavley. Just as a refresher course, committee bills are introduced typically annually, sometimes every other couple of years, but they're essentially code cleanup bills. They're also known as omnibus bills. They deal with relatively routine code changes that are not viewed as controversial by the committee members. They require full concurrence by all members of the committee from both houses in order to be included in the committee bill. The bill addresses several different codes, the water code, the fish and game code, the public resources code. Relevant to this analysis and this discussion, there is a provision in SB 798 that, as initially written, would have reduced the commission's monthly meeting requirement to a requirement to meet no less than 10 times per year. That was subsequently amended at the request of some industry groups to increase it to 11 times per year with no more than 45 days elapsing between meetings. This would give the commission some additional flexibility in scheduling your annual meeting calendar without any requirement or provision that you can't continue to meet 12 times a year. Under the current statute, you could even meet more than 12 times a year. But this would give the commission a modest amount of additional discretion to schedule less than 12 meetings a year if the commission felt that that were warranted. This provision in the bill is similar to a bill that was passed by the legislature back in 2009. That was SB 262 by Assemblyman then Senator Lowenthal. Alan Lowenthal from Long Beach, and that would have reduced the commission's annual meeting requirements to 10 meetings per year, given the commission the ability to cancel a meeting for fiscal reasons, and would have suspended the Public Streamlining Act for the purpose of a canceled meeting so long as anything subject to the Permit Streamlining Act was scheduled for the following meeting. That bill did make it through the legislature. It made it to Governor Schwarzenegger's desk with no registered opposition, but Governor Schwarzenegger did veto that bill. So SB 798 is essentially an opportunity for the legislature to reconsider the question of giving the commission some additional flexibility in your meeting schedules. Again, there's no requirement that you can't continue to meet 12 times a year, but this is consistent with the kind of flexibility that they have been providing to other boards and commissions for fiscal reasons, for just good government efficiency reasons, and because there's a good argument to be made that boards and commissions should have some flexibility in their meeting schedule in order to handle their workload. I would also like to note that it's consistent in principle to many local governments who have what they call a dark month at some point in the year where supervisors and staff can take a little breather and do some of the work that's backlogged, that's difficult to get to because everybody's always in production schedule. So staff had not initially been recommending a position on this bill because committee bills are, we don't generally take positions on committee bills simply because they don't need our help. They're committee bills, they're non-controversial in the legislature, they typically go through the process often on consent. But if the commission would like to take a position on the bill, the staff recommendation would be for a support position today. And with that, unless Charles has anything to add, I'm happy to answer any questions.
I'll take comments and questions, beginning with Commissioner McClure.
This is a bit of my issue, and I'm concerned about people being able to appeal approved projects, because the trigger is that once the appealed project is made, they have 10 days to make that appeal. And if that appeal is then filed, then there's 49 days between when it has to be heard. So I just played with the time a little bit. And for instance, if we chose not to have a December meeting and we received a notice of final action by a entity on November the 2nd, a person could then file an appeal on November the 12th, and then not having a meeting in December, we would then have to go into January, but it will bump the days of the week of how we meet. And, you know, for elected officials, we have lots of other meeting responsibilities, so to move weeks becomes very, very difficult. And the 49 days from November 12th would be December 31st. So there's an issue because we don't control appeals by any means. We have 12 appeals on this current agenda, and of those 12 appeals, five of them, I think, had to be heard at this meeting in order to meet the deadline date. Others were postponed and others were withdrawn. I'm looking at we had five of them, of the 12 appeals that we had on this agenda, were required to be heard in August, or the appellant wouldn't have had their chance at appealing a final action of a project by a local entity. So that, to me, is pretty problematic. If it were written in such a way that you could schedule for 12 and that we're allowed to cancel one, that would, to me, work, because then, as if you didn't get appeals in, you know that you've got this window of time, and it could be handled that way. But to actually schedule it, I think that it's affecting a local person in being able to have their streamlined, guaranteed response from a state agency in relationship to a local government's notice of final action. I also, when I try to look at the bill, and maybe I'm not looking in the right place, but I have a bill analysis that was made on June 30th of 2015. And when I look at that one, the language doesn't switch it to 11. It keeps it at the 10, but it says that the commission shall meet at least 10 times annually at a place convenient to the public, but shall not go for two consecutive months without a meeting. So I don't know what is that. Was that already stricken? Or?
That's a previous version of the bill. So the current version of the bill was as amended July 8th.
Okay, so that was, I'm sorry, because I couldn't find it. So anyway, those are my concerns, and when I do the math on the, and also look at the 180-day, the period that we have on some of our actions that we need to take, that would mean that someone in, if someone had their case was activated in June, and we were supposed to, their 180 days would have needed to be addressed in December. And if we didn't have a meeting in December, we wouldn't be meeting the dates. And I know that it's unintended. I understand. I don't have any heartburn about canceling a meeting or not having 12 meetings. But I have heartburn about the public being able to have their due process and their ability to appeal projects, because there's always a certain amount of panic when there's an approved project by a local entity that the people who are following that project have just that 10 days to kind of get their act together, so to speak, to make that appeal. And if then it just needs to be able to follow the days. And so I don't want us to approve and say, yeah, we support this. This gets passed. And then next year, we're back in here, and people are saying, well, we want to amend the streamline. We want to amend that streamline process for the public, and we want to turn it from 49 days to 60 days. I just think that's – I get it's hard to make the turnaround, but I also get that I need to respect and represent the public who would be, I think, possibly negatively affected by this.
Thank you. Sarah, do you have a response?
Sure, I'll just try to respond quickly. So, Commissioner McClure, the way the bill is currently written, it you could actually cancel a meeting. It's not only for setting the meeting. I guess staff was assuming that would be the way the commission would prefer to proceed. But under the current language, you could cancel a meeting so long as you still held 11 in a year and there weren't more than 45 days elapsing.
I have no heartburn over it, because then staff will know that we're not violating anybody's due process of how to go with their application.
Okay.
So if it can happen that way, I don't have heartburn. But I do have heartburn if it's set at 11. Like, I don't want to see us 15 months out say we're not going to schedule a meeting in December, because 15 months out when we make our calendar, their life is going on in all the local entities.
Again, it's just some additional flexibility. You could implement it whichever way you preferred.
That wasn't clear to me, so that's...
Okay.
Dr. Lester, did you have a comment?
I was just going to say that I haven't done as much thinking about this as maybe some of you have. I did divide 365 by 11 and come up with 33 days between meetings, but I haven't strategized a calendar, but I do think we want to just leave open what we may or may not do with this if it gets passed by the legislature, and you would all have an opportunity to think about the calendar.
And you can do the 33 days between meetings if you divide it by 11, but what that does is it changes the sequencing of when it presents itself during the month.
No, I understand that, but I think it's also something we would like to think about in order to give us more flexibility potentially. Your point, I think, is a really important one, which is we don't want to somehow undermine the ability of the appeal process to function the way it was anticipated.
Right. And I'm also saying, I think, in relationship to the 33 days, that if you start changing it, that it's going to be in the third week this month, the second week next month, the first week the following month, that becomes impossible for people who sit on other commissions and have other duties in relationship to the serving the public. It becomes impossible for our schedules to be maintained.
Thank you. Other comments on this particular aspect? There's other things that we may want to bring up today on legislative, but specific to this discussion. I think that I would just share that I think that it, you know, from my perspective, it's an important tool that I would like us to see have it affected and make it available to us. And, you know, my greatest interest would be for that end of the year kind of mental clear up and not seeing the compaction that occurs around two holiday periods. Without wanting to undermine what Commissioner McClure is talking about, at the same time, if we're going to say that we're going to schedule 12 and then we'll make a decision, you know, at some late moment as to whether or not we can get in or get out, that it has its own challenging scheduling issues associated with it. So I think that we don't have to resolve this today, but I think this is really important to have brought it up so we can be doing the what-ifs. And I also could envision that if we did find that the time of year that we wanted to create that opportunity for not meeting, we could be intending that the only things that we would schedule would be any appeals or any other regulatory actions that are constrained by the timeline, so that it would be a smaller meeting and a more constrained meeting, leaving more of the staff available to take advantage of the purpose that we would have for it. So that's just another thing to think about. I would also agree with Commissioner McClure that we don't want to get into a situation where we are having a moving agenda date for these meetings. That would be problematic for many people, if not everyone. So I think that's a consideration. And I think in that regard, that this idea that no more than 45 days between meetings, it almost sets it up to where if we did decide to reduce by a meeting, we would have to be making at least one change. So it may be that the solution lies more in having 12, but expecting that 12th meeting was a one-day meeting to just deal with whatever we absolutely had to come up with, and also to comply with that 45 days. So with that, unless there is a strong feeling about it, I don't think we need to have more or assert ourselves to the legislature. Commissioner Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I agree with you and with Commissioner McClure. I think these are all important things that we're all, you know, processing, and I think that that's an important role for the commission to play in how we schedule this. I think the concerns that people had initially, and, you know, as this has gone through the process, you know, we started a long time ago, is that the commission really didn't take a position on this issue. We didn't even, we had, you know, brief conversations and not really weighed in as a commission, as a majority, on how this would actually work and all of that. So I think that it created a cloudiness that was unnecessary. I mean, because I think that there are legitimate issues that you are both raising with regard to this. And you know, I mean, again, I think the concern would be that the commission makes a decision when the meetings are scheduled. And if it is the 18 months in advance that we do our schedule now, that doesn't really allow us to address workload and pending issues, et cetera. So, you know, we've seen that, you know, based on the discussion about next month's hearing and, you know, moving that so we can not all be here till 9 o'clock at night every night. But so I don't feel like we've had the ability to really weigh in and have a conversation about that. And that is my concern. You know, 11 meetings I think is fine. And I think your idea about one day or whatever is all great. So it just needs to be, from my perspective, a discussion amongst the commission and a position taken or a process.
A decision made
by the commissioners. The other question I had, and I just had some questions because we were having this discussion at lunch relative to this omnibus bill. 30310.5, so that's the one that it doesn't preclude a person serving from. It repeals the section that said there are no conflicts of interest. Is that
30310.5 repeals the section that it's kind of a double negative. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to make it as clear as possible. Currently, 30310.5 provides essentially an exemption from the doctrine of incompatible offices, which is codified in Government Code Section 1099, with respect to the public appointees, not the elected officials. The elected officials are already if you will, exempt from Government Code 1099 by the fact that they are expressly required to sit on the commission. So 30310.5 extends that to the public members. If it weren't in the Coastal Act, the doctrine of incompatible offices, Government Code 1099, would otherwise apply. Mm-hmm. So the way 1099 works is, unless expressly exempted from that doctrine, it applies. So when 30310.5 is repealed, or if 30310.5 is repealed, the doctrine will apply. None of the seated commissioners are affected by this.
Right.
This was a section that was added to the Coastal Act shortly after it was passed for the to provide for the appointment of a particular individual who served on the commission well, and hasn't been an issue in particular. But the doctrine of incompatible offices is something that has good legal reason for why it applies to boards and commissions, and it's just the prerogative of the legislature to determine whether or not they want it to apply.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been an issue, so I'm unclear why that is being raised, but that's neither here nor there. I think, you know, I go back to, it's hard to find qualified people to serve and willing to commit the amount of time that it takes, so limiting in any way someone who has an expertise in this area, I don't understand that policy. But and then the other one is 30304 doesn't preclude it allows for a non-elected to serve as an alternate to the elected.
So 30304 is the provision that was discussed at some length last meeting. Again, that was a recent amendment to this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the section that allows for a mayor to serve as a locally elected official. Previous to this, the Coastal Act, as it's currently drafted, locally elected officials have to be a member of a city council or a county supervisor. That, by definition, excludes strong mayors, which are not members of the city council. So 30304 has been amended to specifically allow for mayors to serve as locally elected officials on the commission. And the commission expressed unanimous support for that. You couldn't take a position last month because the language wasn't actually in print.
Right. I just I'm reading it, and I wanted to make sure, because it says an alternate, a member of the commission may, subject to confirmation of his or her appointing authority, appoint an alternate member to represent him or her at any commission meeting. An alternate for a local elected official need not also be a locally elected official. That was my understanding of the previous law. So it kind of is going backwards. What the intent was of the legislature, I don't know, was to say that the strong mayor, as you just described, could serve as an alternate or a primary commissioner. But that isn't the way I saw
it. I'm sorry. I'm trying to read the Coastal Act and listen to you at the same time, and I don't have the bill in front of me. I can tell you that the amendments that went into this bill on July 8th relative to the appointments of locally elected officials applied to the direct appointment and also to the alternate who could serve. So under the current version of the bill,
I'm looking at the July 8th version of the bill.
Okay.
And it says, and the italicized language adds, and an alternate for a local elected official need not also be a locally elected official. That just refers to an alternate. It doesn't refer to the primary commissioner. I mean, maybe you can pull up a copy of the actual legislation.
That would be helpful.
I have a copy of the actual bill, the amended version of the
SB 798.
SB 798. So it says right here. So here's the code section 30304. Any member of the commission may, subject to confirmation of his or her appointing power, appoint an alternate member to represent him or her at any commission meeting. And here's the italicized amendment. An alternate for a locally elected official need not also be a locally elected official.
Okay. So there's
that's different
sections,
than
right. There's other sections that have been amended that are not included in this analysis.
I know they're not included in the analysis. I don't see them included in the actual bill because what I'm looking at is the bill in print as it is elected amended on the 8th of July. Not to split hairs, I just want to be clear about what we're talking about because that's not what was said last month and it was not what was said today.
Sarah's trying to pull it up here. From what you're reading, it sounds like the way they've framed it is an alternate, such as a strong mayor, need not also be a local official. A strong mayor not being a local official, so that would provide strong mayor to be an alternate.
An alternate for a locally elected official need not also be a locally elected official. Doesn't say they can be a locally elected official or they can be a strong mayor. I think that's open to serious interpretation. Help me out here, people.
It could be that the language that was shared with me prior to the last meeting is not yet in print. But I don't believe that's the case.
Sarah, I'm going to let Commissioner Schallenberger share some of her experience.
Well, it's not experience. I'm also looking at the language, and I think there are two places that have been changed. One is saying that the what you're reading, Commissioner Mitchell, which has been the practice in the past. We have had cases where locally elected commissioners have had a non-locally elected alternate.
I do.
Okay, so that is current practice, and I believe this is merely clarifying in the law that current practice is legal. In addition, there is the provision that says this bill would authorize the Board of Supervisors and City Selection Committee of each county within a coastal region to also nominate mayors who reside in the region to serve on the commission. As provided. The bill would specify that So there are two things. It says
it's a different section.
That's right, and they're both in there.
303.01.2.
One is codifying existing practice, and one is changing the current law to say that mayors who do not sit on their city council are eligible for a locally elected seat. So I think.
You were correct. I wasn't listed on here as the code sections that were being amended, and so I missed it. Absolutely. That is true, and you're right. It's codifying because the second part is it does codify our existing practice, which is an alternate can be a non-elected official. So I appreciate that clarity.
Commissioner Schallenberger ended that explanation just in time for me to actually pull up the code section on the bill. So so I'm with you now.
Okay, and then just as far as, going forward on other bills and bills like this is just, setting up and talking about long-term, a process by which we take positions on bills and that we engage in these. Because I know, Assemblymember Rendon has a bill on low-cost visitor serving, which is something that we've all, we denied a project yesterday because of Port Master Plan, because of this very issue. And while we are doing workshop after workshop after workshop on the subject, and we may come up with the answer, once that answer that we brilliantly come up with can go to the legislature and get changed. And so I think that there should be some engagement on our part as the commission with regard to legislation like that goes at such a core issue that we have. I was just reading the bill, and it looks like it's on suspense, so it's a two-year bill, but they're looking at having the Conservancy come up with something, and that's sort of the change in that. And I really think that it would be ideal if we came up with, some principles that we could, use to say we as a commission support the idea of changing the policies related to low-cost visitor serving, because we see this as a big issue, and that we would, you know, like to engage on the subject, and here are some of the principles and issues that we've raised. It's not specific language per se that we would prescribe to them, because the legislature, you know, has their role, and we just serve here as their representatives of the people of the state of California. But, you know, to give them our, you know, insight based on having served on the commission and being in the weeds on these items. So I would like to see things like that instead of just letting that bill roll. I don't know what conversations were had with Assemblymember Rendon or, you know, other bills that are on this, but it is a good way for us to engage as a commission on the policies that really impact the work that we're doing and how and things that we've been struggling with as well. So I'd just like to look at, obviously, the last month of session is not a time to have that discussion. Sarah's going to be plenty busy running around. So, but I would like to look at that for future years, because there are opportunities, and particularly just regard to that, it's such a big issue for us, being a two-year bill, that we could really engage on that in a substantive way from a policy perspective from the commission's.
And we agree with you, Commissioner Mitchell. In the conversations that staff had with Assemblymember Rendon and his staff on that, he was always very upfront about the fact that he intended it for it to be a two-year bill, and that he was looking to implement any recommendations that might come out of the end of the workshop process. So that's been the expectation for that bill all along. It may be that bill, it may be another bill, since, as you noted, it is on suspense. But we have been in discussions with his office, and he knows that this commission is very committed to doing all we can to implement that policy.
A quick follow-up on that. When is our next workshop on low-cost visitor serving?
The fall.
I think we're targeting October. Sorry.
Okay.
We've been publicly, I've been saying the fall. That's
Got
what
it.
We've been hearing is the fall. So.
All right. So, and we're just planning on having, because I'm not part of the subcommittee, we're just planning on having three workshops on the subject, and then we'll come together. What will be the resolve of that? We'll come together with a policy.
I don't think we've foreclosed other workshops or discussions. We were just thinking we were going to need another one, and we're hoping that workshop will be more structured around what we've been hearing and considering, and then where to head in terms of recommendations that you might consider or directions that you might want to go in.
Okay. Well, like I said, appreciate all of that. Appreciate your time, and let us late on Friday. Just wanted to get clarity on that, and then, you know, talk about as we go forward, you know, the positions that we're taking instead of sort of not as structured of a process. So thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Bochco?
There we go.
So just a question. It's not related to any given bill. Other than the workshop process, is there any way, if a commissioner or more than one commissioner has a significant interest in a legislative, not a legislative bill. I'm not talking about bills. For instance, if we have a special interest in marine protected areas and we think that maybe they need to be bolstered up legislatively, is there a way that we can interact with you and staff to perhaps be a little more proactive in the process? Because, and again, I don't think this is going to happen very often, but every once in a while there'll something come up and I think, oh shoot, you know, I wish I could go up there and talk to these guys, right? Because, you know, I feel so passionately about something, and I feel that, you know, this role as a commissioner gives me a little bit more credibility, let's say, in on the Hill. So what do you think about that? Is there something that you've, because I don't want to tread on anybody's jurisdiction, but I do feel that I could be helpful sometimes in, and not just me, I'm speaking for a lot of individual commissioners here, or groups of us.
Absolutely, and commissioners can be very helpful with legislative initiatives in Sacramento, and we welcome and we rely on that kind of assistance. I would, and historically over time, commissioners have had lots of great ideas, and obviously the work that you do makes you very familiar with, you know, areas that could be, you know, strengthened or changed or tweaked. Staff has always basically said we are always available to you to talk about ideas that you have. There's a lot, and to help see those ideas get expressed. There's a lot of nuance in Sacramento, and there's a lot of, it's sort of like a foreign country in many ways. There's a lot of plates spinning all the time, and they're usually plates you can't see until they hit you in the head. So by all means, if you have an idea about marine protected areas or whatever, talk to Charles, talk to myself, talk to a district director if it's a district issue, and we will be happy to work with you in terms of kind of laying out the lay of the land. As you know, the commission doesn't typically sponsor legislation for a variety of reasons. We had that report month before last.
Right.
But we can certainly, either direct the organizations that you represent. We can, maybe help clear the path, or oftentimes members will come to us and ask us, hey, I'd like to do a bill on this subject area or that subject area. Do you have any ideas? I actually have a bill idea file in my office so that when members call and say, I want to do a bill on public access, or I want to do a bill on the coastal trail, or I want to do a bill on whatever, I can say, well, here's some ideas you might consider. There's this, there's that. So by all means, it's we're here to help facilitate your relationship with the legislature, not stymie it.
And I just want to add an important thought. Sarah's right, we welcome that interaction and your participation. We hope that it's done in coordination with us. So I think the most important thing is, given the complexity and the rate at which things change and happen and in Sacramento, is that we're coordinated. And so it's important that if you want to work with the legislature on an idea that you think is central to our program, that Sarah know about it and that you guys have discussed the context and are doing that in a coordinated fashion. Otherwise, we might be talking at cross purposes. We might confuse the legislative staff or legislative initiatives. And we certainly would get unexpected results sometimes. And so we would appreciate if you are interested in doing that or are talking about an idea that you just coordinate with us in advance before engaging the legislature.
All right. Well, it's good to know that you guys are really open to that, because, as I said, I don't think it's going to happen very often. But every once in a while, something will really trigger, a passionate response from one or more of us, and it would be good to be able to coordinate, action on it and maybe strategize ways to get things done.
Absolutely, and coordination is the key to that, so I
thank you.
Appreciate that.
Commissioner McClure.
I hate to be I'm not a naysayer about trying to get information and have dialogue open, but I think that as an appointed body, the request needs to come from a body. That if I go to you and say, and I have some idea, let's say, whatever the idea is, that I want to expand the Coastal Act to Highway 5. Sorry, I didn't give you a heart attack, Charles.
I second that.
But I want to expand it to Highway 5, and I want to, let's get this rolling. And I'm talking to you, and knowing that I probably have 8 people here that would say, are you crazy? So that's the difference in having some kind of avenue where it is public, where it's public dialogue here. Because if I were a public member of the community, I would feel of the state coming to you, let's say, to talk about issues for coastal protection. I would have the automatic assumption that the commissioner that was in line ahead of me had more power because they were commissioners. Where that's the reason that we need to do it as a body, because when we come one by one to you, we're coming not as commissioners, we're coming as public citizens, because we don't have the authority of this board. And it could maybe be fixed that there might be a ledge committee designed out of here that they sit and talk with you. But somehow, I don't believe it's okay to have dialogue and set a course of action that hasn't been a defined course of action here. Am I right, Chris? Is that? I don't mean to put you on the spot. I just think that that's where I'm struggling with this idea.
You know, I'm sure Chris has a legal answer about what you can and cannot do individually or collectively, but I think as we tried to convey a few months ago, there are lots of ways that you as the commission can participate in our in a legislative agenda or discussion about different topics. And you know, one of the reasons we have a legislative staff is so that you can be responsive and effective in Sacramento in between meetings. You can't function as a body except when you're assembled in your public hearing. And so we need to be able to have the staff capacity to respond to questions, clarify what the Coastal Act means or how it operates, and work with the legislature on a daily basis. In terms of expressing the commission's view on something as a whole, we do need to do that in a public hearing, and we do that by bringing the report to you every month and you taking positions on bills if necessary or if you're inclined to, like we just finished a discussion about potentially doing that, and that's where the commission as a whole would express its policy preferences or position on something. In terms of the process we were just talking about, if you have ideas, oh, I'd like to expand the Coastal Act to I-5, you know, you could bring that up to us and we could talk about the viability of that, certainly in a separate conversation. You know, is that a good idea? Who might be interested in that? And then, but if it was a viable idea and we thought it was worth pursuing, it would need somebody in the legislature to take that up. That's not the commission taking a position. That's the legislator being interested in an idea, unfolding it, seeing where it goes, and then potentially if it gets comes forward in a bill form, we would bring it to you for consideration and taking a position on it. We would not be expressing positions on bills that had not, in that way, that had not been endorsed by the commission as a whole.
I guess my, I hate to belabor this, but my frustration is wrapped around that at the beginning of this legislative session, we said, can we have a discussion about where we see deficiencies possibly in the Coastal Act or where we see places that we would ask the legislature to see as priority issues? And we were never able to have that discussion. And the discussion was, well, you can go individually. And I just think that kind of leaves us in a weak position, because I think that if the Coastal Commission had priorities of what they would like to see on ledge items, and lots of these legislative items that are here now would be priority items. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's no voice. There's no voice from this side of the dais, we want to take it one by one, and that is kind of frustrating for me.
I thought I had addressed that a couple months ago in our report when I laid out the various ways you could do that with us and as a body, not only one by one as opportunities arise or the need to respond to something comes up, but also in a more comprehensive way through our strategic plan discussions. Or the other example that I presented was there was interest among the commission about addressing affordable housing and understanding that background and history. And so we prepared a report, we brought it forward that included a discussion about, well, given what we know now, is this a viable area for a legislative initiative or not? And that was an opportunity for the commission to have that dialogue and input into the policy area. And so I think we have the mechanisms available for you to do that as a body.
If I'm the only one that has any angst on this, I can drop it. But I just don't feel that we've ironed that out. I don't feel that we've sat up here and talked about what kind of legislative issues or what kind of legislative needs do we have as a Coastal Commission to be able to fulfill the Coastal Act. And I don't know where that discussion happens.
Well, I'm going to suggest that it will continue to come off this dais. I think that it would be useful for us in maybe in our ledge report for our October or November. We could review the bills that have been on suspense or turned into a two-year bill. We could decide whether we have some interest in any of those. We could have a conversation about whether there's other things that we think ought to be getting communicated. And so I think that's a good time for us to have that conversation before you know, we're into the new year and everybody's looking for the bill language.
Just so I'm clear, that would be a conversation of the commission looking at what's pending currently and what may happen, but no agendized list of topics or
no agendized
you
list,
identifying for us what to pursue.
Right. And I was looking through the list on the legislative report this month, I saw, you know, the ones that the bills that we take position on, but there were some that we have no position on that are as important to me or more important. And so distinguishing which ones we actually have a point of view on, I think is an important conversation perhaps to have. And I think we could use this year's legislation as a template for the conversation.
I agree. That was one of the thoughts I expressed a couple months ago, which is, I mean, I don't know how many bills were introduced this year, but there's a lot of bills out there, and we do our best to identify those that we think are relevant to the program, but sometimes we don't identify bills that may directly affect us. Often they're bills that are in somebody else's policy area or statutory authorities, but they affect us, and we may want to do something about it.
Right. So I would just ask then that we do anticipate during one of our fall meetings to be able to have that conversation agendized off of the legislative report. Would that work for commissioners? Would that work for staff?
September meeting.
Right. I think it would be after the September, after the special session.
Yeah, September wouldn't work, but off the top of our heads, November is probably better than October, given what we anticipate to be the load for October.
Very good. I think November's fine, and it could even be as late as December, but I think November is preferable. Are there any other commissioners on this matter? Yes, Commissioner Turnbull Sanders.
I guess I just don't want the comment that Commissioner McClure made to just die on the vine. I really appreciated her comment about potentially having a subcommittee. I think that the subcommittee that she and Commissioner Cox served on for the low-cost visitor serving issues that we've been taking up has been very effective. And so I would like to have a discussion on that. I don't know if now is the appropriate time, but I am interested in possibly exploring that a little bit more.
Well, we can incorporate that into our conversation in November, and I'd be happy to do that. Okay. Are there any other matters that commissioners it's not quite litigation yet, but we had trailed the commissioner reports and other commissioner conversations. I think the main thing would be to just say, is there anything that commissioners would like to share with the full commission and the staff at this time before we adjourn?
One really quick, because I don't want to lose it. Was the permit for the pier south where we're staying, was that whole I don't know if anyone's listening to me that can know the answer. The whole park and the basketball hoop and all of that, it's being utilized amazingly. And it's, while it's not lodging, it's low cost visitor serving. I think it's amazing. And we should really look at that going forward, you know, doing something like that, because while we can't set the price of rooms, we can say you have a public basketball court and picnic tables and all of that. It's just, I sit every morning and watch everyone utilizing it, and I think it's great, and it should be something that we really look at, because it's a different way to serve people in the district. So I just think it was great, and I appreciate the hotel giving us the state rate and all of that, and I just didn't want to forget, because next month we'll be someplace else and I don't track that much information long term.
Okay. With that, as a final comment, we are adjourned for...
We did trail the other statewide reports.
Right. We didn't have reports. I don't believe the Conservancy did not.
Okay. I don't know if Jamie or the AG has a report. No.
Nope.
Okay.
All right. Well, then it's happy trails. And we will see you all in September, or at least many of you in September, in lovely Arcata, California.